The adopted son of filmmaker Woody Allen is defending his father against accusations Allen sexually assaulted his adopted daughter nearly three decades ago. In a lengthy blog post yesterday, Moses Farrow said he can no longer stay silent as his father, quote, continues to be condemned for a crime he did not commit. Moses' younger sister, Dylan Farrow, claims Allen sexually assaulted her when she was seven. Allen has always denied that. Bianca Golodriga shows us Moses' new accusations against his mother. Bianca, good morning.
Good morning. Some detailed accusations at that. Moses Farrow claims his adoptive mother, Mia Farrow, raised her children by coaching, influencing, and rehearsing. He says his father never assaulted his sister, Dylan Farrow, and suggests the story was likely planted in Dylan's head.
There's no morals.
That's Moses Farrow in 1992, publicly denouncing his father, Woody Allen. But in a post on his blog Wednesday, Moses describes that moment as the biggest regret of his life. Moses claims he endured years of mental and physical abuse at the hands of his mother, Mia Farrow, and that led to him being obedient and deeply afraid of her.
I'm told it happened here in the attic of the home.
Yeah.
In 1992, 7-year-old Dylan Farrow claimed she was sexually assaulted by Allen in the attic of her mother's Connecticut home, an allegation she has maintained for nearly 30 years. But Wednesday, Moses said he was with Dylan and his father the day of the alleged assault, and it never happened. He said no one would have allowed Dylan to step away with Allen alone because his mother made them believe he was a monster. Mia Farrow and Allen split a few months before the alleged assault. After it came to light, he was dating Mia Farrow's 21-year-old adopted daughter, Soon Yi.
Mia called me on the phone and said, in the course of an argumentative phone call, she said, I have something very nasty planned for you.
In a 1992 interview with 60 Minutes, Allen denied assaulting Dylan.
Either she has been coached methodically to tell the story because...
By Mia.
By Mia, yeah.
I want to speak out, literally.
In an interview with Gayle King in January, Dylan denied her adoptive mother's alleged scheme.
What I don't understand is how is this crazy story of me being brainwashed and coached more believable than what I'm saying about being sexually assaulted by my father?
Mia Farrow has previously denied being abusive. In a statement, Dylan Farrow called her brother's claims easily disproven and contradicted by years of his own statements. Mia Farrow did not respond to our request for comment. Woody Allen declined to comment. He has not been charged with a crime. Look, this is really heartbreaking.
It is.
And whatever happened that day divided this family permanently. Mm-hmm. And you're hearing multiple sides here. I know you spent a lot of time with Dylan as well.
It's complicated, Bianca. And I did talk to Dylan yesterday. She said, listen, she and her mother both are devastated by Moses' latest turn of events because he's contradicting himself again, she says. And she said, I haven't spoken to him since July 2009. Neither one of us have spoken to him. And because he's never talked to me about it, we've never discussed the incident, how can he say what he's saying? So she has no response to him directly. She said, I don't want my Me Too moment to turn into a very bad version of Family Feud. So she says, I'm not going to respond to him.
Yeah.
It's complicated and heartbreaking on all sides.
There are no winners here.
But when you talk to Dylan, people who talk to Dylan find her very credible and very believable.
Yeah.
And read the reports. The reports say a lot. Yeah. Read the reports on this case. Thank you, Bianca. Thank you.
This is CNN.
DNA. And the DNA allegedly links the famed sportscaster with the crime. The announcer, known for his deep voice, is accused of biting and sexually assaulting a Virginia woman following his broadcast of a New York Knicks-Washington Bullets game last February. A crime lab report found only a 1 in 2.6 billion chance that some samples taken from the woman could have come from anyone other than Albert. Albert faces trial in Arlington, Virginia next month. Last week, his attorneys faced the music for conducting telephone opinion polls in the area. Today, on Burden of Proof, attorney push polling, DNA, and the odds on Marv Albert.
This is Burden of Proof with Roger Cossack and Greta Van Susteren.
Welcome
Hello and welcome to Burden of Proof. As an NBC announcer, Marv Albert has always been famous for his mouth. But lately, attention has focused less on Albert's words and more on his bite. Albert stands accused of biting and sexually assaulting a woman in a hotel room last February.
Yesterday, the Virginia Crime Lab released DNA results showing overwhelming odds that Albert had sexual contact with his accuser. Are the results as damning as they seem, or could the prosecutor's bark be worse than Albert's bite? And is this fair or unfair to Marv Albert?
Joining me here in Los Angeles is jury consultant Joellen Demetrius, and in New York, forensic dentist Douglas King, and criminal defense lawyer Larry Goldman.
All right. Let's go to Joellen. Joellen,
let's make it tough on Joellen
now. All right, Joellen, you've helped a lot of lawyers pick juries in cases. Assume now that you represent, or you work with the lawyers representing Marv Albert. What do you look for in a jury if this bite evidence is likely to come out?
Well, I think what you're going to be looking for is people's attitudes about sex. I mean, there's an element in this case, certainly, of S&M, and you're going to look for those individuals that believe, well, you know, in the privacy of somebody's home or hotel room, you know, what they're into is their own business. And, you know, obviously, I would assume the victim's going to say it wasn't consensual, and he is going to say that it is consensual. So then it becomes a credibility call. So, you know, you're going to look for people that may identify a little bit more with Marv Albert, that, you know, may have some of those alleged predilections themselves. I mean, that's sort of hard to get in terms of questions, you know. What type of sex do you participate in?
Joellen, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but and as best you can and on the spot, you know, how do you go about finding that kind of stuff out? How do you ask that question so you don't get people upset?
Well, traditionally, consultants have found that out two ways. One is through community attitude surveys, which I know have become an issue in this case, and the other is through focus group. And probably a focus group is a much better way to do that, because it's more of a qualitative study of getting together a group of people that represent your jury population and saying, you know, here are the issues in the case. Tell me what you think about them. Do you think that there is an element that what he's saying is correct, that there was, in fact, consent involved in it? That's probably the best way, but in looking at kind of overall defense themes, one of the ways you do that is through a community attitude survey, which is a telephonic survey randomly done in the community in which the trial will be held.
And that's assuming that the defense is consent, something we don't know yet. We don't know what the defense is going to be. Maybe he's going to say that the evidence was planted. We'll find out at trial.
Gus T. Renegade, the Black O.J. Simpson. Just making sure we don't have any confusion. Gus T. is not supporting on the sly R. Kelly. That is not what is happening. Although I am calling attention to, he does have a trial that is happening right now that is very relevant to a lot of the subject matter of this text. But this should not in any way be construed as support, defense of R. Kelly. All of that said, context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, and for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, September 16, 2021. So I have been told I will have to include a segment. We will have to hear from Simone Biles. Time is right and exact. We will have to hear from Simone Biles during the book club today. So many things are pertinent to exactly what we're talking about in this book. What does Gus T. say all the time? White people do not care about children. On display in this text, in my view, in the film work of Woody Allen, certainly in what is happening right now, current events, Olympic legend Simone Biles. All of that said, this is the book club, our seventh session on Woody Allen's Apropos of Nothing. Come on. Let me ask that question again. So we got the title that this book is about nothing. So why write it if you just have nothing to say? Why do we think Woody Allen, Woody wrote this here book that was published in 2020 in the middle of the Rona. Why do we think he published this book in 2020? For what purpose? What does he want the readers to take away from this book that's about nothing? What we heard Moses, Pharaoh at the beginning of the segment. That is one of the non-white adopted children of Mia Farrow. Moses, like Moses Malone, basketball player, black male, faux, Philadelphia legend. And then Moses, like in the Bible as well, biblical names. But him commenting in defense of Woody Allen on saying that Mia Farrow was horrible and convinced them of all this nonsense that absolutely did not happen. You can check out his blog post and see he's written about all of this over the years. See what he has to say. Hey, he says that Mia Farrow was also not a great adopted white mom. No surprise here. For years, I have spoken against so-called transracial adoption abduction. Check that out for yourself if you would like to hear more of the system of white supremacy, racial masochism. Non-white people do frequently speak on behalf of suspected racists. Very unfortunate. Next, we heard Greta Van Susteren. Many folks credit the beginning of her illustrious television journalism career with the O.J. Simpson trial. We heard from her during the reading of Jeffrey Toobin's book. They interviewed Joellen Demetrius. If you have a good memory and you paid attention during the O.J. Simpson trial, you remember that name. In fact, if you watched the FX series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, you saw her character, white woman who helped them pick the jury and told Johnny Cochran et al., hey, get black females on this jury. They will get O.J. Simpson free. They listened. We all read the rest of the story, but they interviewed her about, hey, this Marv Albert trial. That also, talk about timing. Marv Albert just retired. Literally weeks ago, he just retired. All this happened, him being arrested and charged with forcible sodomy. All that happened. He was off the air for about 2 years, got rehired, and spent the next 20 years broadcasting and covering all the big games, watching black males just like Woody Allen. Marv, I had forgotten about all this. I will read a little bit just to remind folks of the charges, and then we'll point out Joellen Demetrius and talking about how she's saying how they would go about getting this information and all of this. This is in the LA Times. We read a lot of their reports during the O.J. Simpson trial. The report is titled Surprise Witness Tells of Encounter with Albert. This is dated September 25, 1997. Today is the 16th of September. It reads, I'm not going to read the entire thing. The witness, Patricia Masden, white woman, said she got to know Marv Albert during the early 1990s when she traveled with the New York Knicks and was the VIP liaison for Hyatt Hotels. Her story was the most shocking yet in Albert's forcible sodomy and assault trial. Albert is not on trial in connection with the alleged incident, but Circuit Judge Benjamin N. A. Kendrick let her tell her story to show what prosecutors say was a pattern of conduct. Talk about those patterns. She said he summoned her to his room in Dallas in 1994, saying he needed help sending a fax. When she entered Albert's room and announced her presence, she heard him say, "Come on in." I turned around and saw him standing there. She said, "I saw him standing there in white panties and garter belt. He was exposed and he was aroused." Masden said there was an earlier encounter in 1993, one in Miami, in which Albert asked for oral sex and she refused. She also said he asked me if I was interested in a menage a trois, specifically three-way sex with another man. Woody Allen has a scene about a three-way in the movie Manhattan, and a number of his accusers said that they were involved in a three-way, even a three-way with Woody Allen and Mia Farrow. I include all of this because I read last week in Woody Allen's article, Notes from a Know-Nothing Knicks Fan. Woody Allen wrote this piece back around the same time that Marv Albert was arrested. In fact, shortly afterwards. And what did he say? What about Marv Albert? I'd like to see him back doing the New York broadcast. I miss that voice full of city street urgency. He made the games exciting to listen to, and to deny him his place as the voice of the Knicks is unworthy of those who are empowered to hire. I don't know if I should read the part about he was charged with forcible sodomy, or should I read the part about him requesting a menage a trois while he had on white panties and a garter belt. That is the voice of the New York Knicks, and it was for years, and then it just became the voice of the NBA. I was so tempted to play some of the tributes because literally this is just days ago. They were giving tributes to Marv Albert saying exactly what Woody Albert said. Oh my gosh, he is so exciting and so amazing. They said he was just as important as Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. They got pictures of bite marks, not one, not two, not three. What LeBron James said, not one, not two, not three, not four, about eight of them. I might have been 12 bite marks. We talk about pattern of behavior. So Woody Allen, Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey Epstein, Marv Albert. Just trying to look at, what is it? Patterns of conduct amongst individuals classified as white. What does it mean to be white? What is white culture? Said white panties and a garter belt, a three-way with another male. Apropos of nothing, audio segment one.
My mind's telling me no, but my body's telling me yes.
So August 4th, 1992, I float up to Connecticut to see my kids as haggled by our lawyers. It's an uneventful afternoon. Mia goes out shopping while I watch a little TV with a room full of people, all warned to keep an eye on me. Read Moses' account. He was there. I wander to the pool alone. While they continue to watch, I make a phone call or two to kill time. Soon Mia comes back. It is determined that I will stay over in her guest room, and Mia and I will have dinner later to discuss more details of custody and visitation. Soon the sun goes down and night falls in the country, and I check to make sure Mia casts a reflection in the mirror. We go to have a quick bite to eat in town. The atmosphere is, shall we say, frosty. All that's missing is me turning my back and her emptying the contents of her ring in my drink. Talk is sparse, but civil. Nothing brilliant from me, no Joan Crawford moments from her. Back to the house, me to my isolated quarters, nodding off while clutching the fireplace poker in the event Dick or Perry should show up, or even Mia, who I recalled had given me a hostile Valentine's card with an actual terrifying kitchen knife stuck viciously through the heart. Next morning I rise, have breakfast, spend an hour with Dylan and Satchel while they deliriously check off every toy in the catalog they would like me to bring next time I come up. It was a great morning for the three of us. Who knew it would be the last? Anyhow, I go back to the city. I resume my life, mosquito-free and mercifully on concrete. No more bearded fescue for a while. The next day, I went for a scheduled visit with Susan Coates, Dylan Shrink, who I was conferring with to try and navigate the waters and do what was best for the kids. She broke the news to me that I was being accused of molestation and she had to report it. It was the law. I was dumbfounded and couldn't believe it. I thought the whole notion was preposterous. I said, no problem, report it. Coates would testify that, unlike actual predators, I made no attempt to dissuade her from reporting it. That was because I hadn't done anything and assumed no sane person would take the idea of me molesting anybody seriously. What had happened was that during my visit, while Mia had gone shopping, after explaining to everyone that I had to be watched carefully, all the kids and the babysitters were in the den watching TV, a room full of people. There were no seats for me, so I sat on the floor and might have leaned my head back on the sofa on Dylan's lap for a moment. I certainly didn't do anything improper to her. I was in a room full of people watching TV mid-afternoon. Allison, the nervous babysitter for Mia's friend's children, prompted by Mia to be hypervigilant, reported to her employer, Casey, that at one point I had my head on Dylan's lap. Even if so, it was utterly harmless and totally appropriate. No one said I molested Dylan, but when Casey phoned Mia the following day and said her babysitter reported my head on Dylan's lap, Mia ran to Dylan. According to Monica, the nanny, she said, "I've got him." The head on the lap would over time somehow metamorphosize into my molesting her in the attic. But that reenactment of Dori Previn's song scenario would come later. At that point, the thought I might need a criminal lawyer would never have blipped anywhere on my radar scope. I had a domestic lawyer who was up and back with Mia's lawyer often, but it never occurred to me for a New York second that a totally non-existent event, obviously made up by a woman who deeply sought vengeance, would turn into an international cavalcade, an industry that would cost millions and millions of dollars and touch many lives. Incidentally, I had been the victim of a false accusation once before when I was in my 20s, and if the Mia one was March hair time, get this, I'm 25, I'm working as a comedian. Suddenly I get a call from my manager that a woman is suing me. She claims I'm Ferdinand Goglia. Who, you ask? Ferdinand Goglia, her long-lost husband. Suddenly, I'm being served papers by Mrs. Goglia. She saw me on TV, my manager says, and claims I'm her husband, who abandoned her. You must be kidding, I reply, while cumulonimbus clouds gather just above my head. No, says my manager. She says Ferdinand, a garage mechanic, always made the same jokes as you did when she saw you on TV. And he has ducked out on her, and you're him, with the same glasses, and you owe her a bundle of back alimony. I told you this was nuts. I'm Ferdinand Goglia. Meanwhile, as the screwball suit is for real, the flag over at Becker in London, my attorney's firm, gets thrown, and my salary starts ticking away. I have to go to court to defend myself. Believe it or not, I have to prove I'm not Ferdinand Goglia, and that I was never married to Annabel Goglia. It seems outlandish. I can tell my lawyer is wondering if it's possible a woman is telling the truth. Could I have been married to her under a different name? And did I skip out? My lawyer asked Jack Rollins. My manager calms my lawyer down, assuring him I am not the Lannister spouse here accused. But even he is operating on faith. For all Jack Rollins really knows of my past life, I could be a deceptive deadbeat. So what saved me after months and much precious speech he doled out to my legal beagles? Only that the woman was truly Looney Tunes, and when I showed up in court, trying not to dress in anything like I imagined Ferdinand Goglia would wear, she failed to show up. We came with all the evidence we could muster, and was finally deemed by the court I was not Annabelle's ex, who was much older than me and who fled her, and no wonder. She was batty, and thank God she never resurfaced. So, back to my latest surreal adventure. Try and imagine where I'm coming from here. I never laid a finger on Dylan, never did anything to her that could be even misconstrued as abusing her. It was a total fabrication from start to finish, every subatomic particle of it, no different from I'm the Goglia character. The sheer illogic seemed to me dispositive. I mean, it makes no sense why a 57-year-old man who has never been accused of a single impropriety in his life, while in the midst of a contentious and very public custody fight, drives up to the hostile environment of the country home belonging to the woman who hates him most, and in a house full of people sympathetic to her, this man who is thrilled as he has just recently found the serious love of his life, a woman he'd go on to marry and have a family with, would suddenly choose that time and place to become a child molester and abuse his 7-year-old daughter, whom he loved. It defied simple common sense, especially since I had been alone with Dylan many times in my apartment over the years, and if I were actually a fiend, I had ample opportunity to act like one. Yet it makes perfect sense for the angry woman who had announced she would take away my daughter and had a plan worse than death for me to resort to the single most common cliche of custody warfare, accusing the spouse of abusing the child. And yet, despite the obviousness of it all, it soon became clear that this Bubba Meister, which never occurred anywhere in space-time and had now swung into ham-fisted action, would not vanish, but would blossom into, as I said, an industry. Did it not look suspicious to anyone that it was Mia who brought the molestation idea to Dylan? Dylan did not come to her mother and say she had been touched. Mia came over to Dylan and suggested it to her. Dylan denied it. Mia needed to get her to change her denial. She took her to the doctor in search of something she could use as evidence. The doctor asked Dylan if she had been abused. Dylan said no. Mia took her for ice cream and returned to the doctor's office, where the 7-year-old had somehow changed her story. We see this pattern repeated over and over, as Moses has so vividly described, that is being coached, threatened, even beaten to learn to recite false stories as Mia dictates them. Moses' harrowing account confirms this. Quote, "One summer, when the wallpaper was being redone," Moses writes, "I was getting ready to go to sleep when my mother came over to my bed and found a tape measure. She gave me a piercing look and asked if I had taken it, as she had been looking for it all day. I stood in front of her frozen. She asked why it was on my bed. I told her I didn't know, that perhaps a workman had left it there. She asked again and again. When I didn't give the answer she wanted, she slapped my face, knocking off my glasses. She told me I was lying and directed me to tell my brothers and sisters that I had taken the tape measure. Through my tears, I listened to her as she explained that we would rehearse what should have happened. She would walk into the room, and I would tell her I was sorry for taking the tape measure, that I had taken it to play with, and that I would never do it again. She made me rehearse it at least a half dozen times. That was the start of her coaching, drilling, scripting, and rehearsing, in essence, brainwashing. Mia then subjected Dylan to taping her naked over a period of a few days to try and get her to tell the story Mia had made up. And failing to create a tape that convinced anybody, in fact, it backfired and showed up Mia's nail-fisted coaching technique, in desperation, she allowed material that only she had possession of to magically find its way up to Fox News. A self-serving, though not very maternal, exploitation of her naked 7-year-old. Moses recalls, it was the nanny Monica who later testified that she saw Mia taping Dylan describe how Woody had supposedly touched her in the attic, saying it took Mia 2 or 3 days to make the recording. In Monica's testimony, she said, I recall Miss Farrow saying to Dylan at the time, Dylan, what did Daddy do? And what did he do next? Dylan appeared not to be interested, and Miss Farrow would stop taping for a while and then continue. I can vouch for this, having witnessed some of this procedure myself. When another one of Dylan's therapists, Dr. Nancy Schultz, criticized the making of the video and questioned the legitimacy of the content, she too was fired immediately by Mia. Again, common sense. Why would a mother subject a 7-year-old daughter to a prolonged naked taping of what, if true, would be a traumatic experience except to create a spectacle in an attempt to harm the father? So isn't it obvious what was going on? Did it even need an investigation? And yet, it had not one, but two major investigations, one by the Child Sexual Abuse Clinic at the Yale New Haven Hospital, whom the police used, to look into such matters, and one by New York State Child Welfare. Unlike so many women who complained of sexual misconduct only to have their complaints swept under the rug and not taken seriously, Mia's accusation was taken most seriously. It would be followed up on by the law, investigated by a few groups of experts, including the most renowned one in the country, the above-mentioned Yale New Haven Child Sexual Abuse Clinic, whom the police hired. I quote their written conclusion. It is our expert opinion that Dylan was not sexually abused by Mr. Allen. Further, we believe that Dylan's statements on videotape and her statements to us during our evaluation do not refer to actual events that occurred to her on August 4, 1992. In developing our opinion, we considered three hypotheses to explain Dylan's statements. First, that Dylan's statements were true and that Mr. Allen had sexually abused her. Second, that Dylan's statements were not true but were made up by an emotionally vulnerable child who was caught up in a disturbed family and who was responding to the stresses of the family. And third, that Dylan was coached or influenced by her mother, Ms. Farrow. While we can conclude that Dylan was not sexually abused, we cannot be definitive about whether the second formulation by itself or the third formulation by itself is true. We believe that it is more likely that a combination of these two formulations best explain Dylan's allegations of sexual abuse. Is this a good moment to point out the reason Dylan was taken by Mia to see a pediatric shrink long before any of this occurred was that Dylan had serious problems telling the difference between reality and fantasy? I mean, how could her mom have an easier mark to convince she was abused? A little girl, just turned 7, who has been in treatment because under normal circumstances she has problems telling what's real from what's fantasy, is taken from a loving father forever, placed in the hands of her out-of-control mother during an emotionally confusing crisis, suggested to by her mother that she was abused, then her denials are finessed over years of contact with only one parent, and she is taught, led over time to believe she has been molested. I did not suggest this story of Mia coaching. It was a conclusion the Yale investigation brought up. In addition to the Yale investigation, the molestation accusation was dismissed by New York State child welfare investigators who examined the case scrupulously for 14 months and came to the following conclusion from the letter received on October 7, 1993. I quote, "No credible evidence was found that the child named in this report has been abused or maltreated. This report has therefore been considered unfounded." But prior to these reports coming out, a custody hearing was set up in court. There are still people who think the custody hearing was some kind of trial and somehow I beat some imaginary rap. There are still loonies who think I married my daughter, who think Soon-Yi was my child, who think Mia was my wife, who think I adopted Soon-Yi, who think that Obama wasn't American. But there was never any trial. I was never charged with anything. As it was clear to the investigators, nothing had ever occurred. What followed over the next months was a feeding frenzy and a dumb waste of money, mostly mine. Psychiatrists were interviewed, pediatricians, private detectives were hired, publicists had their day, the tabloids cleaned up, the custody hearing went before Judge Elliot Wilk, who hated me from the minute he set eyes on me. And who could blame him? From his perspective, a wonderful, beautiful mother who adopted disabled children, trusted a slimy, scheming boyfriend, a roué, who seduced her daughter, 35 years younger than him, and exploited the poor college student for pornographic photos. All that's missing from this picture of me is a dungeon in my basement where I kept co-eds chained to the wall. One could understand Judge Wilk's first impression, an impression he would never rise above despite all evidence to the contrary. Wilk was a political liberal who at one time had a photo of Che Guevara on his wall. I later discovered he was not quite the noble protector of women he played at for Mia's approval. In fact, if trying to take sexual advantage of a woman based on the superior inequality of one's position is harassment, Wilk would be sweating it out before the Me Too bench. He and I did not like each other and neither tried to hide it, which was not to my advantage in a battle where he is the decider. I didn't endear myself to him when I was quoted in the press saying, "This case needs a Solomon. Unfortunately, we got Roy Bean." Not long after the custody hearing, Wilk died of a brain tumor, which was ironic, as I was asked early in the proceedings by a magazine if losing custody of the children wasn't the worst thing that could happen to me. And I said, no, the worst thing would be getting an inoperable brain tumor. This honest reply did not sit well with the righteous, who felt I was casting doubts on my devotion as a parent. Nevertheless, I wasn't lying. Then what happens? The poor judge gets just that, a fatal brain tumor. I hated the judge, but felt bad when I heard he was diagnosed so tragically. Harsher ones around me were less moved by his plight and quipped it was the only time in his career justice was actually served. I couldn't bring myself to see it as a proportional response by fate, despite all the trouble he had caused. The public also jumped on me when in discussing my love for Sun Yi, I said the heart wants what it wants. They found it selfish, but few, if anyone, realized I was simply quoting Saul Bellow, quoting Emily Dickinson, not actually describing a philosophy of my own. Anyhow, Wilk's irresponsible mischief extended much beyond my experience with him. A child shrink told me the worst cases of suffering for kids he dealt with inevitably came from judgments in the Wilk court. Another weeping mother told me Wilk had ruled against her because she had to postpone a court date to attend her child's birthday and he wouldn't hear of it. Another woman told me he ruled for her but refused to ever enforce the ruling, so it was as if she'd lost the case. Finally, the gifted still photographer, Lynn Goldsmith, told me this story. She had been before Judge Wilk in a case where he ruled in her favor. A day later, he showed up at her apartment unannounced and tried to sleep with her. When she resisted and pointed out he was married, it did not seem to matter. He persisted. She finally got rid of him. Talk about exploiting one's status. But that's the kind of man I was at the mercy of. Still, when the Yale investigation concluded that Mia had likely coached Dylan and no molestation had taken place, I felt he should have at least taken a fairer look at things. Clearly, though, he was profoundly disappointed at the results of the investigation and squirmed to find some face-saving angle, finally criticizing Yale for destroying their notes. As it turned out, that was Yale's and FBI's procedure to protect privacy. And one can only imagine if Yale had concluded, "I molested Dylan," the fact that they destroyed their notes would have been a non-issue, and he would have had the report reprinted in gold leaf editions. The police case was headed by Frank Mako, who hired Yale. Dr. Coates, Dylan's shrink, thought the Connecticut police were anti-Semitic, a card I never liked to play. While she was in Connecticut being interviewed, one of the police told her Miss Farrow did what she should have done when the girl was abused. She rebaptized all the children. Poor Mako must have been crushed when Yale concluded no molestation took place. To go to court with such a high-profile case would have made his career, but not if he lost it. And when reality set in, he sadly had to grasp that any fantasies he might have had of using the Farrow case to advance his dreams of glory were out the window. He kept the case open for months, all during the custody hearing, which served no purpose except as a big help to Mia's side. But why? What was in it for him to hurt me? When the aforementioned Sandy Bollock and Judy Hollister worked in Mia's house at that time, they individually described how Mako would show up unannounced now and then, reeking of cheap cologne, their words, and that Mia would dress up and make up and go to lunch with him. This was apparently Mako's idea of conducting an impartial, unprejudiced investigation. No question it was curious when Mako finally dropped the case and said he could have pursued it, but didn't want to upset Dylan. A number of lawyers told me that that was not very ethical, and there was an article in the New York Times that agreed, calling Mako's behavior a violation of my civil liberties. That trying to keep alive the question of my innocence or guilt, though it had been concluded there had been no molestation, was a gift to Mia, is undeniable. But let's be honest. You really think he finally closed the case because he didn't want to hurt Dylan? This excuse by a clown who subjected the poor 7-year-old to police interviews, who never said anything about Mia taping her naked and never squawked when Supermom dragged Dylan to a doctor who knocked the poor kid unconscious with an anesthetic so she could have her probed vaginally in search of any morsel of evidence, but of course nothing was found. I feel reasonable people might disagree that it was concern for Dylan that caused District Attorney Mako to let his case fade away. The truth was, Mako was a sad schlemiel who I believe would have given his right arm and both of Dylan's to prosecute had he the slightest chance of a win. Of course, when the very investigating experts you yourself hire come back and conclude nothing ever happened, that the girl was very inconsistent, told the investigators at one point she was not molested and not in the attic with her father, and appeared to be perhaps coached by her mother, the chances of a conviction lose a certain gale force. He had curried favor with Mia, who charmed the most sophisticated men, much less a buffoon who might have fantasized he would be her knight and savior. And finally, if you don't believe me, here's what Judge Wilk wrote regarding Mako's claim that he had cause to prosecute. Quote, "The evidence suggests that it is unlikely that Allen could be successfully prosecuted for sexual abuse," unquote. During the court procedure, I was so naive, I assumed if you perjured yourself, you went to jail. But it didn't seem to matter. When people were exposed in court as liars, Mia would swear under oath I was and had been seeing a psychiatrist because of inappropriate relations with young girls. When that was completely disproven, there was no penalty for lying. One person told of Dylan grabbing my thumb on an occasion and sucking it. Moses says in all his years around us both, he never once saw anything like it. Of course he didn't, because it never happened. Nevertheless, even that fabrication is a far cry from the lie Ronan concocted when he wrote years later that I would force my thumb into her mouth. How about when Mia's myrmidons contacted Stacy Nelkin and asked her flat out if she'd lie and say she was underage when we went out? Of course she wouldn't. Here's one amusing highlight. Mia's team comes in and accuses me of recently using call girls for illicit sex, anything to paint me as a sleazeball. I deny it. They claim they have proof. I still deny it, but I can see my lawyers look at one another wondering if I'm being honest with them. The bad guys send their proof. Photocopies of a credit card with my name on it for a number of escorts and massage virtuosos. I hold to my denial, and everyone now is really giving me the fisheye. Turns out, upon closer investigation, it's a different Woody Allen. Some poor guy from the Midwest was in New York and treated himself to a brace of hookers. Who dreamed there was another Woody Allen? I must remember that next time I get a request to do a benefit. Where was I? Okay. The liberals I always had great admiration for disappointed me. Murray Kempton had been an idol. He came one day to cover the hearing and shellacked me in his next column. He excoriated me for having a battery of lawyers to Mia's one or two. But I needed the child custody lawyers. Plus, I was also being accused of a criminal thing, molestation. So I needed my criminal lawyers. But he made it sound like I was this rich, powerful guy with lots of money and many lawyers versus this poor, betrayed mother. I wondered why he didn't look deeper into the fake molestation charges and why he came down on me so hard simply because I couldn't remember the exact name of the shoe store where I took my kids to buy them shoes. He really had it in for me, and I recalled that some years back he had liked my New Yorker pieces and wanted to do an interview with me. I was flattered and said okay, but I did not want to do an interview for the Post, as it was at that time a particularly awful tabloid. We went up and back over it. He said, it's who he writes for. In fact, he was a fine, crusading liberal, but I didn't want to contribute in any way to the Post in those years. So I held firm and passed on the interview. He waited a long time to get even, but he did get even, and then some. Gloria Steinem was another journalist I really admired, who railed against me. No one seemed interested in pursuing what was at least a possible miscarriage of justice. Steinem simply accepted the accusation as true, and insightful as she has been over the years, here she was wrong. Another amusing moment in the courtroom was Alan Dershowitz screaming at a lawyer, "Perjurer, perjurer," from the witness stand. The issue was that my lawyers had accused Dershowitz of saying he could make the whole case go away for $7 million. Four lawyers in a room testified he made that offer. He denied it furiously, his mother looking on proudly in the courtroom as her son performed. But I understood it and have always said openly that I did not think it was the shakedown my lawyers thought it was, but an attempt to keep both Mia and me from getting into a messy public conflict. I recall him saying the issue should not go to court. It should be settled quietly, sparing us both mudslinging publicity. He and Mia calculated my kids' school expenses for their lives through college. Three kids, support, private schools, college. Anyhow, his adding machine came to 7 million skins. But I wouldn't settle. I said, I don't care about bad publicity. I never abused Dylan, and I'm not settling for a dime. I was not afraid of the truth and was not going to buy silence. I couldn't care less about my reputation. I was ready to go to court and declare with total honesty that I never abused anyone in my life, and I was ready to defend that statement publicly. Let Yale investigate. Let New York State investigate. I welcomed a closer look by experts. I took a lie detector test from someone the Connecticut police had the highest respect for, Paul Miner. He was the chief polygraph examiner for the FBI from 1978 to 1987. I passed easily, but when we asked Mia to take the same test, she refused. I knew I had truth on my side, which I now know is no assurance of anything. And those William Steig cufflinks my Aunt Molly bought me for my bar mitzvah, which depicted a man with a spear through his body and the caption, "People are no damn good," was an insight that trumped Anne Frank's. Resigned to the fact I would need a top child custody lawyer and an experienced criminal lawyer, and despite being a total novice in these areas, I wound up with two strong professionals, Sheila Riesel and Elkin Abramowitz. Elkin is a tall liberal Democrat who had headed the criminal division in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District, had served as assistant deputy mayor for the city of New York, and also as special counsel for the Select Committee on Crime for the U.S. House of Representatives. He agreed to see me, and I spieled out the whole story. He instantly said the strategy of not talking to the Connecticut police should now be reversed. He felt my story was so clear and consistent that he would go there with me, and I should tell it to the police. My previous lawyers had kept me from going, and I must say, with good reason. We had agreed to be interviewed by the Connecticut police when they requested it, as long as there was a stenographer there to record the interview. Mako did not want any record of it. This did not exactly inspire trust among our team, so we didn't go. Elkin, however, after hearing my whole story, felt it was so clear I was innocent that we should go. I went. They asked questions. I answered. They were polite, in no way hostile, no good cop, bad cop nonsense. I do recall one creepy moment the following week. They asked if I'd give them a hair sample. I didn't have that many to spare, but felt I could manage a few strands and suggested the gray ones. I was fingerprinted, just like the criminals I'd grown up fascinated by, and then they sat me down to yank a few hairs from my head. Because I was a celebrity, they let me know they were pulling the hairs out gently, giving me an easy one, was the way they put it. And as I sat there for the first time, I realized what it would be like for a non-celebrity, a poor person, a black man, he wouldn't get this special treatment. His hairs would be yanked out mercilessly with no regard for pain. It was the real world I was coming in contact with, and though it's real for everyone, it's more real for some than others. During the hearing, I was informed about a very hot underground source, a private eye with underworld connections who could get the inside skinny on anyone, uncover any unscrupulous mischief planned against me, and bring my opponent's case to its knees. He came to my apartment, and I gave him the now tedious tale in all its detail. I gave him my opponent's phone numbers, daily habits, anything I could be helpful with. He left. That was the last time I ever heard from him. Was he a con artist? A double agent? Did I turn him off with something I said? He didn't do anything to harm me, just vanished. During the maelstrom of the custody hearings, two professions exposed themselves as surprisingly disappointing. One was private detectives. After all, I had at one time considered becoming one. Entranced as I was by Sam Spade and Mike Hammer, I saw myself having my own office, feet up on the desk, fedora cocked back, shoulder holster, beautiful secretary with a crush on me while I solved crimes way ahead of the bumbling police. The reality that I would have been beaten to death or turned up in an alley with bullet holes through both eyes hadn't occurred to me. The dicks I met and dealt with were nothing like Bogart or William Powell. They were mostly overweight ex-cops with a few old friends on the force, allowing them minimal access to information an energetic high school freshman could secure. The thought of them tailing someone without falling down a manhole or solving a crime more complex than jaywalking was ludicrous. As for the dynamite blondes, the idea of Veronica Lake heating up over some paunchy Seamus who couldn't score with a nymphomaniac on a desert island using Spanish fly made me laugh. Much money spent, little bang for my buck. The other losers were the child psychiatrists. How intimidated they felt by Mia. A few whined to me in private that they had to toe the line or they'd be fired. One child shrink phoned and begged me not to let him be called to the witness stand as he was so terrified he couldn't sleep nights. Another, who was no help, complained he could not get Mia and Satchel to separate, and the first steps of treatment was to get her into the other room. One shrink plaintively asked me if I could possibly help get his son into the movie business because the boy lacked direction. All the shrinks walked on eggshells with Mia, enabling her to prevent me from having any contact with my kids. The one seeing Dylan in Connecticut was taking his marching orders from Mia, as his daughter had been hired by her as some kind of assistant. Judge Wilk, who was supervising the case, found nothing wrong with any of this when I pointed it out. But then, this is the same guy who read the Yale report and still concluded there was no evidence that Mia had coached Dylan. This despite Yale's prolonged, meticulous investigation versus his total zero investigation. What was this guy smoking? And why was he twisting and wriggling to find some way to help Mia? During the hearing, the Yale report was finished up, and the investigators summoned both Mia and myself into their office to read us the results in person. We sat there as they read their conclusion. Dylan was not abused by Mr. Allen. Her statements had a rehearsed quality. They were likely coached or influenced by her mother. Moses says those conclusions perfectly match my own childhood experience. Coaching, influencing, and rehearsing are three words that sum up exactly how my mother tried to raise us. Mia rose in a rage. She's given to rages, as Moses described, Sunyi described, and the Yale report confirmed. She stormed out of the room. I said goodbye, anxious to get back to New York. While exiting, I chatted for a second with one of the investigators who told me that Dylan had been very inconsistent and even said at one point that I had never molested her and she was never in the attic with me. Shortly after Sandy Bullock started working in the Faro house, she saw Dylan crying and asked her why she was crying, and the child said, "Mommy wants me to lie." A short time later, Dylan had been rewarded with a new doll previously denied to her. Despite the obvious prejudice of Wilkes' reaction to the Yale report and his duplicitous face-saving comments, it is held up as a valid, extensive, and correctly concluded report. The investigation took 6 months. Every conceivably relevant person was interviewed. Dylan 9 times. Me, Mia, kids, babysitters, maids. Then suddenly, Mako's and Wilkes' dreams of playing hero to Mia went up in smoke. The custody hearing ended, and like Mako, Judge Wilkes scrambled to write a summary that could do the most damage to me. The best he could come up with in his effort to torpedo the report was the following. I am less certain than is the Yale New Haven team that the evidence proves conclusively that there was no sexual abuse. Of course, Wilk based his conclusion on never having done any investigating whatsoever, just wishful thinking, whereas Yale New Haven had investigated the case minutely for months. If Wilk had sat in on a typical Yale investigating session, he might have seen one like this one I will describe to you. Get this picture. Mia and I are both sitting before 3 experienced professional investigators in a New Haven office. Mia insists I molested Dylan, claiming poor Dylan was so upset by the abuse that she instantly went running into the next room and into the arms of her sister Locke, who she would go to for comfort. Mia described in detail how Dylan embraced Locke, shaken by the experience, and poured her heart out to her sister, who calmed her. I, K.G. Fox that I was, listened carefully to Mia dramatize the story to the investigators and waited to play my ace. I said, you're telling me Dylan was so traumatized she fled weeping into the embrace of Lark? Mia stood her ground, rubbing in the child's need for succor by her older sibling. Why do you ask? The investigators queried me. Because, I said, rising like Lincoln, ready to do his bit about no full moon, just a waning moon that night. Because, I explained, Locke was not in Connecticut when you alleged that happened. She was in New York. So how could Dylan have run and embraced her? An awkward silence filled the air, and Mia, scrambling for a reply and thinking on her feet, says, I know Locke was in New York at that time, but Dylan embraced her spiritually. This was the kind of tap dancing I was up against, and while it may have played to Judge Wilk and Mia's base, it did not fool the investigators. As regards the salacious question, which people always ask me, was there ever any canoodling between Mako and Mia or Wilk and Mia, I find that hard to believe. But I tend to be naive in such matters. In Double Indemnity, when Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck were kissing each other hotly in the bedroom of his sleazy apartment, as the screen faded to black, I thought it was so that we wouldn't see them die Easter eggs. I had contempt for Mako and no respect for Wilk, but that's all I can say. I must argue Wilk mandated a stupid, vindictive, and harmful visitation plan for me and the kids. I will explain it, see what you think. First off, no visitation at all with Dylan. Why was that fair or good for me or her? Despite the investigation concluding there was no molestation, I still can't see her. Thanks to Wilk, the kid is totally cut off from her father, completely under the aegis of her implanting, coaching, naked-taping mother, and I never get to have any contact with her. And so I never was able to speak to Dylan after that ruling. Between the court edict and manipulation, not a single word or note has been passed or been allowed between us since she was 7. This was a brutal blow to me, a cruel deprivation for Dylan, but the successful culmination of, you took my daughter, now I'll take yours. Dylan told the Yale probers, my mommy said daddy did a bad thing, but I still love him. Dylan and I had bonded deeply, and Mia's plan to take my daughter took a great toll on me, and no doubt on a child just turned 7, who lost the father she was very attached to. I adored Dylan and spent as much time with her as possible from her infancy on. I played with her, bought her endless toys, dolls, stuffed animals, My Little Ponies. In those days, F.A.O. Schwartz was a kid's paradise, and they used to let me in early before it opened so I could shop for Dylan and Satchel. As a boy, my father had a millionaire friend from Chicago who would visit New York on business now and then and always wanted my father as his driver. My father would drop everything to chauffeur Mr. Lorenz. Once he took my father to FAO Schwartz and said, "Buy your son anything you want on me." My father got me a complete realistic cowboy costume, including two six-shooters. I was about seven and thrilled. I looked great, but got my spurs caught in the bedspread, crashed, and broke a lamp. Once when my father hit his number, he went to FAO Schwartz and bought me a huge Lionel chemistry set because I showed an interest in science. Worried about my safety, he called his druggist friend and read him the list of every chemical and asked which ones were dangerous. He flushed the dangerous ones down the toilet, leaving me half a set. I still managed to create an orange dye and dyed my mother's dark brown beaver coat orange. For some reason, this upset her, and she tried killing me with a salad fork. I put that scene in Radio Days. I remember her chasing me around the house, brandishing her shoe. I thought they were going to have to hose her down like in The Hairy Ape. Speaking of shoes, incidentally, once Dylan had her heart set on the ruby red slippers Dorothy wore in The Wizard of Oz, I stayed up until midnight having the costume department of my movie make her a pair so I could leave them on her bed and she could discover them when she woke up in the morning. I was crushed when Mia's plan worked, and the judge shilled for her to make sure I would not get to see Dylan. For a year, I had dreams about her coming back to me, but every waking attempt I meant to see her, to write to her, to talk to her, was thwarted. When she got a little older, and I imagined she would realize how she was being used, I wrote her just sweet, affectionate, brief letters asking how she was doing. No commercials for me. The letters were all intercepted by Ronan, and I received curt, evasive answers that began, "I told Dylan about your letter, and she is not interested." In Hitchcock's Notorious, another unnaturally creepy mother-son relationship plays out. Claude Rains and his mother have Ingrid Bergman in their house, and they're slowly poisoning her, as Mia was doing to poor Dylan's mind. They disconnected Bergman's phone, so she couldn't have contact with Cary Grant. Finally, he goes over and rescues her, but that's the movies. In real life, if I tried what Cary Grant tried, I couldn't get past the doorman. I finally wrote Satchel and said, "Do you always open your sister's mail and read it?" No answer, except he wrote back that if I really wanted to help out, I should send money. I already was supporting them generously by law, but if Mia was right about Satchel being the son of Frank Sinatra, then I was really being bilked. One of the saddest things of my life was that I was deprived of the years of raising Dylan and could only dream about showing her Manhattan and the joys of Paris and Rome. To this day, Sun Yi and I would welcome Dylan with open arms if she'd ever want to reach out to us as Moses did, but so far, that's still only a dream. Anyhow, you think that was a wise judicial decision, given the options available? I think it was not only deliberately cruel to me, but also catastrophic for Dylan, as you will later see. As far as Satchel went, I was allowed supervised visitation. But why supervised? No logical reason. Supervised means a hired person, often different each week, must attend and be present during the visits. What for? If no molestation ever took place, what are we talking about? Not that I was accused of laying a finger on Satchel, although at one point the written record shows that Mia was so disconnected, she tried to sell the notion I may have molested both of them, but when it didn't fly with Satchel and Dylan was more vulnerable, she concentrated on her. But why must I be supervised? All it does is confirm to Satchel his father is to be feared, a threat. But I loved him and wanted to see him. So I was faced with accepting Wilkes' only route to visitation, and every week after hearing from his mother, I'm a rapist and a monster, the poor kid is packed off to ride an hour and a half to New York from Connecticut to be with the predatory old man. The psychiatrist on the case said custody should go to the parent who does not poison the children against the other parent. Bear this in mind when you now read what was written by a dissenting appeals court judge who felt the visitation rules for Satchel and me were too restrictive. His opinion comes from two eyewitness accounts by two experienced professional custody supervisors, Francis Greenberg and Virginia Lehman, both independent social workers who were charged with supervising the visits with Satchel in New York. They reported their findings to one of the appeals judges, Jay Caro, who wrote, quote, There is strong evidence in the record from neutral observers that Mr. Allen and Satchel basically have a warm and loving father-son relationship, but that the relationship is in jeopardy in large measure because Mr. Allen is being estranged and alienated by his son by the current custody and visitation arrangement. Francis Greenberg and Virginia Lehman, two independent social workers employed to oversee visitation with Satchel, testified how Mr. Allen would welcome Satchel by hugging him, telling him how much he loved him and how much he missed him. Also described by both supervisors was a kind of sequence that Mr. Allen might say, "I love you as much as the river," and Satchel would say something to the effect that, "I love you as much as New York City." Then Mr. Allen might say, "I love you as much as the stars," and Satchel would say, "I love you as much as the universe." Sadly, there was also testimony from these witnesses that Satchel had told Mr. Allen, "I like you, but I am not supposed to love you." That's when Mr. Allen asked Satchel if he would send him a postcard from a planned trip to California with Miss Farrow. Satchel said, "I can't, because Mommy won't let me." And on one occasion, when Satchel indicated that he wanted to stay with Mr. Allen longer than the allotted two-hour visit, Satchel did say he could not stay longer, that his mother had told him that 2 hours was sufficient. Perhaps most distressing, Satchel indicated to Mr. Allen that he was seeing a doctor that was going to help him not to see Mr. Allen anymore, and he indicated that he was supposed to be seeing this doctor perhaps 8 or 10 times, at the end of which he would no longer have to see Mr. Allen. In contrast to what apparently is being expressed by Miss Farrow about Mr. Allen to Satchel, Mr. Allen has been reported to say only positive things to Satchel about Miss Farrow and conveys only loving regards to Moses and Dylan through Satchel. My God, what more does anyone need to see regarding what was going on in the Farrow home after Judge Wilk turned both children over to Mia exclusively? Are the two independent social workers' testimonies different from the constant brainwashing Moses witnessed? So after months of Mia poisoning the 5-year-old, the brainwashing takes. Professional supervisors are hard to find and expensive, and part-time monitors come and go. Young women, maybe college age, maybe a bit older, show up at Mia's each visitation day. Mia preps them for their encounter with me, giving their instructions to other babysitters to keep a close watch on me, and armed with one or two nasty things the judge had to say about me, she sends our son, groomed to despise me, on this journey to Manhattan hell. It would be as if I gave the supervisors the Yale report to read before she met Mia. They'd look at her with very different eyes. Naturally, as time passes, the kid enters my apartment with the supervisor, carsick, belligerent, raging with ambivalence, having been taught I'm Moloch in Ralph Lauren corduroys. Then comes the stiff, unnatural, awkward mess of a supervised visit, meaning that instead of a father and son spending some nice time doing something together, there's always a third person right there to be sure I don't rape the poor kid. Not only that, if I take him for lunch or ice cream, there's a third at the table with us. I can't take him for a walk without the supervisor, or to a basketball game or movie without me springing for an extra ticket. Most of the girls who supervised were nice. A few were kind and could see the ugly unfairness of what was happening and tried as best they could to leave us alone. A few were stupid and had been intimidated by Mia's poisonous briefing. They gave me a hard time on the visits, acting as insipid martinets. After a year of this nonsense, I put an end to it, realizing it was not bringing Satchel closer to me, but was pushing him further away. This is what's out there in matrimonial court. Guys like Judge Wilk, capricious men with the power to regulate families. On several occasions, I was stopped in the street by strangers, sad men begging me to help them see their children who were taken from them in custody rulings. One wept, like I could intervene, like I'm a celebrity, so I must have some juice. Meanwhile, I was supervised myself and Mia given free rein over the children. And what awfulness went on under her twisted rule? Moses was there when this little episode, which, as Blanche would say, only Mr. Poe, Mr. Edgar Allan Poe, took place. Listen to Moses, who who was there and described things. Quote, after Ronan finished law school, Mia had him undergo cosmetic surgery to extend his legs and gain a few inches of height. I told her I couldn't imagine putting someone through the ordeal for cosmetic reasons. My mother's response was simple. You need to be tall to have a career in politics. It was, of course, a long and painful process for Ronan, who had his legs broken a few times and reconstructed to lengthen them. The insurance company didn't see the medical necessity and refused to pay for it. Of course, Mia and Ronan tell a different story, but that's what happened. The covering story handed out about Ronan's knee problems, his walker, and months of reconstruction was based on his actual contracting of a disease while working abroad. This was supposed to account for the surgery, but Moses was present during much of the painful process. Meanwhile, Mia might put Ronan through this leg-breaking barbarism to satisfy her plans for his future, while I'm the one the judge sticks with a monitor. Yes, Wilk punished me, but he left two children in sole possession of a woman capable of some dicey behavior. The children become pawns and are deprived of a loving parent, taught to fear and hate their father. Poor Dylan grows up, the fake story relentlessly drummed into her that she was abused. Same with Satchel. Kids of 7 and 4, easy pickings, totally dependent on only their controlling mother. I did not dislike Mia's lawyers. Court is an adversarial place, and one gets angry at the rotten tricks and nasty accusations. But the lawyers are hired guns, and Mia could have easily hired mine and me hers. I had two terrific lawyers, Sheila Riesel and Elkin Abramowitz, and they presented a winning case. But while the molestation nonsense was seen through by the experts, when it came to the Wilk matrimonial court, Sheila Riesel found herself at a boat race. I liked Alan Dershowitz. I believed he tried to find a way to minimize the damage to our reputations, but he didn't know Mia well enough to know she was an extremely troubled woman, a convincing actress whose word couldn't be counted on. Maybe I should have said something when Mia forged a friendship during the hearings with Wilk's court clerk, who drove her home from the courthouse many nights. Was that cricket? Certainly it was an unfair conduit to the judge. Anyhow, too late to lock that barn door. People who followed the newspaper accounts often came away saying, all show business people lead crazy lives. He's nuts and Mia's no better. They're both insane. Many viewed it as he says, she says, and accorded our conflict a false equivalency. The real truth was that it was she says, and not just he says, but every single investigation of the facts also says what he says. It was not simply a dispute between two balanced positions, but between one already determined valid and the other closely scrutinized and found to be false. Nevertheless, it didn't matter to the public, and why should it? There are much more pressing things to pay attention to in the world than the tabloid adventures of a couple of strutters and fretters and their slapstick passions.
Context of white supremacy. So that's audio segment A. We will pick up the second segment. First sentence will be, so now, back to Soon Yi and me. All that's really important. Context of white supremacy. The number to dial if you have thoughts on the first portion of the reading is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. The email, if you want to write your commentary in, UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. We'll share your thoughts, observations on the broadcast. Let's see, before I get to some of the callers and even before I get to some of my notes for this week's session, let's see, get to one of the folks who wrote in. Let's see, one of our investors wrote in. Let's see if I can lengthen the window out. Here we go. I recall that Howard Stern, we heard so much of him during O.J. Simpson, so much overlap, was highly critical of Woody Allen and his relationship with Sun Yi during his radio show over an extended period of time during the 1990s. Maybe we'll hear more of Howard Stern. I suspect this book was, oh, there's our question, why was this book written? Let's see. I suspect this book was written as a part of an ongoing public relations war between Allen and Farrow. Allen's motivation is to maintain his ability to make movies and not get Me Too'd out of public life. He mentioned Me Too this week. I found part of this timeline in a Vanity Fair article which detailed the war of words between Farrow and Allen. 1997 to 2013, 6-year hiatus after the child abuse investigation. November 2013, Dylan Farrow goes on record in Vanity Fair article, "He abused me." January 2014, Woody Allen gets a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Golden Globes. February 2001, Dylan Farrow opened blog to New York Times. February 2014, People Magazine, Moses Farrow defends Allen. February 7, all this is the first week of February 2014, Woody Allen defends himself in the New York Times, his local paper. October 2017, Ronan Farrow Me Too article in New Yorker talks about Harvey Weinstein. October 2017, Woody Allen quoted by BBC, "I feel sorry for Harvey," then backtracks. Uh-oh. December 2017, Ronan Farrow in LA Times goes after Allen. January 2018, Dylan Farrow interview with Gail King about Allen abuse. January 2018, Woody denies in a statement to CBS. September 2018, Sun Yi Previn interview with the New York Magazine defending Allen. February 2019, Amazon backs out of a $68 million movie deal with Allen for TV shows. Allen sues, then settles. March 2nd, 2020, apropos of nothing, is announced by Hatchet Books and they back out due to the controversy. March 23rd, 2020, the book is published by Arcade. February 2021, Allen v. Farrow documentary on HBO. March 2021, How Did Woody Allen Become Woody Allen? Favorable documentary to him on YouTube by Sebastian Perrineau, seemingly based on his book. And that would pretty much catch us up to there, but lots of back and forth and going both ways. These are all powerful white people, even the children now, because they're so old, Sun Yi and Ronan Farrow is a journalist in his own right. So these are all very powerful people with lots of connections and a big, powerful white network to share their views and get out their perspective and all the rest of it. So lots of back and forth over the years. Let's see. Number one, Allen continues his thorough blame game, including Judge Elliot Wilk, Detective Frank Marco, Ronan Farrow, writers Murray Kemp and Gloria Steinman, lawyer Alan Dershowitz, O.J. Simpson, and the loser child psychiatrists. Number two, for the first time, I realized what it would be like for a non-celebrity, a poor person, a black man. I found this epiphany in a nearly 60-year-old, powerful white male, not credible, more of his feigning of naivete. I agree. And even that passage, like, I felt like it was even feigning sympathy, because I mean, you don't portray any black people in your film, so it's not like you connect to them. That's not how you connect to New York City, the black New Yorkians and their experience. That's not you. Tawana Brawley, that's not you. Spike Lee, that's not you. Other than basketball players, and even that doesn't come through in your films. Patrick, you know, shout out to Patrick Ewing, Clyde Walt Frazier, Bernard King. Let's see. Ronan undergoing, number three, Ronan undergoing surgery to lengthen his legs was fascinating. I had never heard of this. I wonder how often this is done for cosmetic reasons if what Alan says is true. What does this say about white culture? That is in Gattaca. Now, that's not me seeing it, but at least that is a repetition of the same type of thing, undergoing some sort of really barbarous, probably really painful surgery just for cosmetic reasons. Like, you don't have a health problem, there's no issue. Undergoing this surgery to make you taller, if that's, I don't even know if such a thing is possible, but that is depicted in the movie Gattaca. Where white people are, Ethan Hawke is in that one. Remember, he was in Training Day. Uma Thurman as well from Pulp Fiction, Harvey Weinstein, and Quentin Tarantino. Yeah, Gattaca. Check that one out, maybe. Let's see. We'll stop there, I reckon, and pick up the rest of these for the second audio segment. Email again, untiljustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Our caller who's saying maybe they fooled us. Maybe this book doesn't really deal with the abuse allegations in Sun Yi. As I said, this, I think, is going to dominate the remainder of the book. And we should have like 2-3 more sessions to go. So this is going to be a lot of what we'll be hearing about and talking about Woody Allen on the defensive. *61, if you have thoughts, questions, again, what does it mean to be white? Why do we think Mr. Allen wrote this book? Had it published in 2020, middle of the Rona. Let's see, I'll check. See if we have hands, and then I'll share a few thoughts while I look out, see if folks have things they would like to share in the first portion of the reading. Let's see. Some of the things that stood out. So when he's going over this whole August 4 visit where these accusations about his misconduct, and hey, I wasn't there. I have no idea what happened on August 4th. Although I am looking, him being married to Sun Yi 35 years, I think sometimes they say the proof is in the pudding. But in terms of August 4, I don't know, I wasn't there. So he starts writing about this event, and he says, I checked to make sure that Mia casts a reflection in the mirror. Like all of this, like joking and his kind of Woody Allen-esque style of humor, and I've said he does a lot of that where he's joking in the middle of talking about these accusations. Like, for me, it just does not sit right. It's difficult to take somebody serious, particularly if we're talking about sexual abuse and child molestation. This person is making jokes. Like, I get it, there's acrimony between the two of you, got it, we can skip all that, just get to, you know, your perspective, your view on what took place here. Let's see, it's because he continues with, he checks to make sure she casts a reflection, the atmosphere is, shall we say, frosty. All that's missing is me turning my back and her emptying the contents of her ring in my drink. Oh, why are you there? Let's meet on a neutral site. They do that a lot of times if it's going to be, particularly if we're talking about dissolving a partnership and child visitation. Let's do this on a neutral site. Anyway, so he does all this being silly and getting too... the meat of the accusations. Let's see. So he has Dylan's psychologist, who calls a shrink, Susan Coates, says that she would testify that unlike actual predators, I made no attempt to dissuade her from reporting it. That's because I hadn't done anything and assumed that no sane person would take the idea of me molesting anybody seriously. That didn't stand out to me as being, oh, wow, he definitely didn't do this. This is a powerful white man. Again, he's not just a white man with money. This is a white man who's been to the White House twice. and bragged about the powerful white people that he hangs out with. I've been to the Playboy Mansion and I've visited the Queen. This is not, just as he said, this is not your average white man. I'm certainly not a Negro. R. Kelly or what have you being charged about anything. Like, I got all kinds of homies in the newspaper, the New York, not just some rag, the New York Times and other publications. Like, whatever, say whatever you're going to say. You got your power. I got my white power and my white PR power, which is mighty even to this day. Got this book out. Let's see. Next. I feel like Woody Allen's narcissism comes through on a pretty regular basis in terms of him having a really elevated sense of himself. The whole biography, he's narrating it. He hops in the films repeatedly. We've talked about that in reading this text. But he says a totally non-existent event, obviously made up by a woman who deeply sought vengeance, would turn into an international cavalcade, an industry that would cost millions and millions of dollars and touch many lives. Unending, and he's a major part of that industry. This book is a part of that industry. Let's see. He says, back to my latest surreal adventure. It was a total fabrication from start to finish, every subatomic particle of it. I'll even stop right there. I feel like the exaggerated detail of it gave me pause, every subatomic particle of it. That's the type of thing where I stop and I look at Sun Yi. I don't know about every subatomic particle, but okay. Maybe you didn't do this specifically, or maybe you did. I don't know. He continues, I mean, it makes no sense. He said that several times when he was on 60 Minutes in responding. It was in the early 90s. And he said they asked him if he did this and he didn't answer their question. He says, is it logical? He answered their question with the same phrasing. Is it logical? Does it make sense that I, a 56 or 55 year old man, would go into the house? He says, it makes no sense why a 57 year old man who has never been accused of a single impropriety in his life, while in the midst of a contentious and very public custody fight, drives up to a hostile environment of the country home belonging to the woman who hates him most. We can pause there. One, his account is contested in court. Moses Pharaoh acknowledged he didn't know where Dylan was at all times during this visit when Woody Allen was at the residence. And Woody Allen, in court during the custody hearing, he conceded that he was not around Moses Pharaoh for the entire weekend. So there were times where their presence, Woody Allen, Dylan, their presence was not accounted for. Anyway, let's see. And he goes from all this, like, I mean, it makes no sense. It's not logical. Why would I do this when I just was just thrilled as I just recently found the serious love of my life? A woman he'd go on to marry and have a family with would suddenly choose that time and place to become a child molester and abuse his 7-year-old daughter, whom he loved. Now, that word love can be used to obfuscate and cover up a whole lot. That's an odd way of describing thrilled. Woody Allen is thrilled that he just recently found the serious love of his life. A woman, stop right there, as opposed to woman who happens to be 35 years younger than me and the adopted child of the woman who I just said is Dracula. That would hit a little bit, it would at least give me pause, like, I get just what I just said. I don't know what you did on August 4th, but I'm looking at Sun Yi. Continuing, he says that he accuses Mia Farrow of resorting to the single most common cliche of custody warfare, accusing the spouse of abusing the child. Really? Is that true? Like, or I don't consider myself an expert on jurisprudence and divorce matters, but is that true? in a custody matter, they accused the husband of abusing the sexually abusing the child. Like, really? Infidelity, I could see, maybe, or not paying child support, but sexually molesting the child? Is that the most common cliche? You all can let me know if you've heard that often. Let's see. We played Moses' account at the beginning, defending his father. As I said, he has a blog post where you can read in it. You can read it in its entirety. He's written repeatedly over time, defending his father, Woody Allen, and talking about the abuse of his mother, Mia Farrow. I've said consistently, hey, I oppose transracial adoption. No caping for Mia Farrow. It could be totally true. It would just be more evidence of why all this trotting the globe and stealing non-white children, that has been a long time act of racism for white Hollywood entertainers. Charlize Theron and Angelina Jolie. Long time. I think Madonna was even involved in that long running activity. Even The Blonde Side, Sandra Bullock, believe that's her, long running activity of whites in Hollywood go around and snatch little destitute non-white children from all parts of the globe. Let's see. The Yale New Haven report, that's talked about. You can read that. That's another one that is contentious and goes back and forth and people, in terms of folks talking about the validity of it. Do they think it's valid? I do know in the custody hearing that the judge that he hates, Judge Wilkes did not believe the Yale report. You have to check out his analysis to see why it was he didn't think this report was valid. He gave it less credibility. Let's see. The New York State Child Welfare Investigation. I thought that portion was really important. This comes up in the documentary in terms of Paul Williams, the black male investigator. He was on the case. Now, Woody Allen's attorneys, defenders say, hey, Paul Williams was dismissed because he was rude. Of course, we got an angry, rude black male. Of course. He contends, hey, he told reporters that he did believe Dylan Farrow when she said that Woody Allen had sexually molested her. He believed her, and he thought that there was evidence to continue the investigation. He was removed. He said he was pressured by more powerful people within the Department of Child Welfare, and they took over the investigation. It was unfounded. Woody Allen is a very powerful white man, and I mean, hey, there are lots of reports, books, studies about how the Child Welfare Service and these allegations of abuse or neglect, as Woody Allen stated, it works very differently if you are a black person, male or female, as opposed to being Woody Allen. It works very differently even if you are a white person and you're not Woody Allen, Woody. That right there would have been enough, like, wait a minute, we gotta go do some sort of, what's your name again? Woody. Let's see. Next, again, I don't know if these are like sections, chapters, they're not titled or anything. I don't know how he concluded that Judge Elliot Wilk, another white man presumably, hated him from the very minute he set eyes on him. I have no idea how he concluded that. Judge is supposed to be impartial. Why would he hate him immediately? I didn't get enough evidence on that. He says Wilk was a political liberal. Now, I thought Woody Allen had said that he liked liberals before. He mentioned them previously. I don't know what that means. I don't use that term. But he says Wilk was a political liberal who at one time had a photo of Che Guevara on his wall. I don't know if that's a positive thing or a negative thing in Allen's view. I later discovered he was not quite the noble protector of women he played at for Mia's approval. In fact, if trying to take sexual advantage of a woman based on the superior inequality of one's position is harassment, Wilk would be sweating it out before the Me Too bench, there's one mention. He and I did not like each other and neither tried to hide it, which was not to my advantage in a battle where he was the decider. I didn't endear myself to him when I was quoted in the press. I'll make sure I get the rest of it. I didn't endear myself to him when I was quoted in the press saying this case needs a Solomon. Unfortunately, we got Roy Bean. Now, again, I'm not really sure why he hated Wilk immediately. He didn't give me enough detail. Like, what did he do immediately? Was this on site? Did he already know something about this guy where he was thinking like, oh no, he's gonna be over here caping for Mia Farrow and those blue eyes, he's gonna fall for it and just trying to slip out with her on the side and all this, like, little extra detail on this part. Let's see. He says the public also jumped on me when in discussing my love. There's that L word again. The public also jumped on me when in discussing my love for Soon Yi. I said the heart wants what it wants. What, Woody? They found it selfish, but few, if anyone, realized I was simply quoting Saul Bellow, quoting Emily Dickinson, not actually describing a philosophy of my own. Could have fooled us. Even in my view, in that portion, I've talked so much about how Woody Allen, I think, hides so much of his racism and misconduct in this. I'm an intellectual. I'm steeped in being a thinker. I'm a thinking white man. And that's so much of the charm and appeal of Woody Allen. Like, oh, yeah, I'm an intellectual. I appreciate the wit and cleverness of Woody Allen and his films. You know, it's not that old lowbrow bathroom humor that everybody else participates in. All of that to cover homoeroticism, sex with children. I mean, that is the hallmark, in my view, of all that Greco-Roman society. Lesbo, the island of Lesbos and sleeping with children and all of that. Mentor, that's why so many talked about not using the word mentor. That would be it right here. Woody Allen being a mentor to Soon Yi, going back to the Greek origin of the word. Pause right there. Let's see. Person who dialed in 1159. 1159, if you have commentary, should be with us.
Greetings, guys. Greetings, callers and listeners. To answer your question, I am not aware of white men or white people being accused of sexually assaulting their children in regards to divorce proceedings. I am, however, aware of white people in general, white men and women, raping non-white children and their own children. And this is kind of frequent across the entire planet from my studies and my understanding. So, yeah, to answer that question, no, but... And I did not get to catch the first part of the audiobook. Did you guys already? I mean, did everyone do the second part already, Gus?
Didn't get that far yet, sir.
Thank you.
For sure. Yeah, I said I'm not familiar with that. Like I said, I don't claim to be an expert on what happens in divorce proceedings. I don't have children myself, so I haven't sat through a lot of these, but I've not heard, like, I've heard, you know, from other males who've gone through that proceeding and what have you, and I've heard, you know, lots of the critiques and criticisms that they have of that process. I'm not remembering anyone offhand is like, man, they accused me of molesting the child. Like, no, not that I can think of. A lot of things, child support, lots of things I can think of, not being accused of being a child molester. But other, like I said, let me know. Maybe I just, you know, not well informed. Let's see.
One more thing, if I may.
Yes, sir.
I heard you say that he quoted that the heart wants what the heart wants. If I understand you correctly, he didn't say that he didn't really mean what, like, that quote. He was just trying to get around quoting what he quoted. And I'm thinking, well, why would you quote it if you didn't mean it? Like, who quotes something that and they don't mean to quote? You know, there's always a reason for quoting something. So his heart wanted a young non-white victim to further victimize. And he had the white power to acquire it, as most white people do. I'm Eli Lyon.
I'm a use Woody Allen. What is it? Now that sounds logical. That sounds like common sense, what he said. I guess people can give their thoughts on that as well. Woody Allen said, hey, is this common sense? Is this logical that a 57-year-old at the time, 57-year-old white man who just found the love of his life, who's 35 years younger than him, and the adopted daughter of the female that he's trying to distance, or that he's been dating for 12 years, the love of his life now, 21 years old, yes. Is it logical, common sense for him to, at this moment, in this setting, to molest his adopted 7-year-old daughter? He didn't adopt her, but, you know. Folks can process, think about all that. This is convoluted. Like, man, some of the children, they did adopt together, and some of them they didn't. They have one biological child together. Like, it is convoluted, like, keeping track of all of this. At any rate, folks can think about that too. Is that logical? Next portion, let's see. When he gives this big account of like all of Judge Wilkes' alleged transgressions, all of this may be true. Like, I have no idea, if he did these things or not. He said he's deceased now, so he can't even be here to, you know, say yay or nay or speak on his behalf. But he doesn't include names for any of this except for the last anecdote. Like when he says, another weeping mother told me Wilk had ruled against her because she had to postpone a court date to attend her child's birthday and all this. Like, you can't verify any of this. You can't check any of this stuff to see if it's accurate or not. The last one, he says, the gifted still photographer Lynn Goldsmith told me this story. She had been before Judge Wilk in a case where he ruled in her favor. A day later, he showed up in her apartment unannounced and tried to sleep with her. When she resisted and pointed out he was married, it did not matter. He persisted. Finally, she got rid of him. Talk about exploiting one's status. It seems like that is a pattern in white culture. White men and white women exploiting their power to take advantage of those sexually who have less power. Frequently, that will be non-white people, like Sun Yi. Frequently, non-white people. Lots of that sort of misconduct. So that doesn't surprise me at all. And I'll even check to see if, what's her name again? Lynn Goldsmith. Maybe she wrote something about that incident online. Let's see. He says later folks tried to make it out like he was this rich, powerful guy with lots of money and many lawyers versus this poor, betrayed mother. You are a rich, powerful guy with lots of money and many lawyers. Now, Mia Farrow's a white woman. She's pretty powerful, too. But I mean, hey, facts, man. But that's what it seems so important. Woody Allen and just portraying himself as this, I'm just a dumb, ignorant victim, nobody white dude. Like, I'm not smart, I'm not intelligent, I'm not a high thinking person, I'm just an old victim, I'm nobody, I'm not scheming. That seems really important to his, I'd say, both his ability to practice racism, so that he can kind of disarm people and think of him as not threatening, I'm just a dumb guy, and then also a part of his camouflage. Of course I couldn't have done these things, I'm just, you know, a nobody, I'm just a dumb, you know, Schlemiel, you know, I'm just an idiot. I'm nobody. I'm not even very smart. I'm not intelligent at all. Let's see. He used that word again as well. He says, went back up and over it. He said, it's who he wrote for. In fact, he was a fine crusading liberal, but I didn't want to contribute in any way. This is when he had this big to-do about Murray Kempton, who he says he didn't like either, who got upset because he didn't want to do an interview for the New York Post. Incidentally, the New York Post had a big front page picture of he and Sun Yi back in the 90s when all of this was first being reported. And it says, it's love. They used exactly what he said. They didn't say it's molestation, child rape, this is crazy, what is he doing? It's love. So I don't know if that was just a tabloid, let's sell some papers, we know everybody loves Woody Allen, or, you know, maybe even if Woody Allen wasn't a friend of theirs at that time, maybe they still like, Woody Allen is our guy, Mr. New York. Let's see. he says when he's getting on like Gloria Steinem and all these other folks and saying, you know, no count Gloria Steinem. She was wrong this time. She's done some great work, but she was wrong on this one. No one seemed interested in pursuing what was at least a possible miscarriage of justice. Like, are you serious, Woody Allen? Like, you have so many defenders who harass me on social media and who come out and write pieces in your honor. Alec Baldwin, major journalist. He got an opportunity to speak the New York Times. Come and give your defense, Woody Allen. Write it up. Like, get out of here. Like, that is so consistent in the system of white supremacy to pretend, to act like, oh, we're in such a weak position and they're just victimizing and woe is me, just beat up on poor little me. Let's see. The caller unknown from the unknown galaxy should be with us as well. Yes, sir.
Hello, Mr. Renegade.
Greetings.
Yeah, much I can say about this book. first of all, it's just more of vile rantings, in my opinion. As I said from the start, it's just mitigating circumstances for the judge to go over and try and find him innocent somehow. Anyway, there's a couple of points. You brought up one about, I wish I took notes on these things down. He said, once again, all horrible things about everybody, hasn't got anything nice. And I find it hard to listen to him because it feels like he's trying to program my mind in some way. It makes me feel uneasy. Another point that came to mind, because, I mean, Mr. Renegade, is just like in the O.J. Simpson book where you had your conclusion that he was a guilty man, and after reading the book, you came to the conclusion that he wasn't guilty. I hope the same thing doesn't happen in this book. That's what I was thinking. That, after everything said and done, we all say he's innocent. And I was also thinking, if I was a racist white man, no matter the glove didn't fit, I still think he was guilty, O.J. Simpson, because I'm a racist and I don't like the black man. Maybe it's the same that I'm doing as a black man to Mr. Allen, just crucifying him before I know the whole story. But I don't really like him, so it's easy for me to crucify him. Just the same way as a white racist find it easy to crucify O.J. Simpson. So that was just in the back of my mind. If we're all getting excited about his guilt before we know the whole story. Anyway, that's one thing. And there's so many other things, Gus, but I just don't write them down. It's late and I'm not paying attention properly, but things come up. I'm trying to remember it as I speak. Maybe I will come back in, because if that's okay, Mr. Renegade.
For sure, for sure. We'll have our second audio segment, so if it jogs some of the important points or more important things that you want to make sure you share before we wrap things up, feel free. Again, the Sun Yi thing does kind of weigh heavily on this one. Like, man, talk about having a piece of living human evidence in front of you. Like, ooh-wee. Guess it depends on how you feel about all that. Let's see. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? Speaking of second audio, before we get to that, let's see. I thought it was significant, the little portion where he's talking about police officers and that romanticizing enforcement officers, and he uses the slang term dicks to refer to police officers. I thought that was significant for this text. Then he says, as for the dynamite blondes, the idea of Veronica Lake heating up over some paunchy Shamu who couldn't score with a nymphomaniac on a desert island using Spanish fly made me laugh. Wow. In a book about child molestation and sexual misconduct, wow. What a set. I think that's at least the second time where I've been like, man, the editor, I would admit, I don't know if we want to use the nymphomaniac metaphor right here. Maybe we can pick a different metaphor. Let's see.
Mr. Renegade.
Yes, sir.
I remember one thing. It was a time when he referred to the... hang on. In your first episode, when he was being interviewed by the 60 Minutes, you brought it up already because he used like the exact same words. And because he had done the interview and he's reading the book, he said it in the same way, Gus. Just like it was something that he was quite happy with and he rehearsed it and said, yes, I'm going to be saying these words because it was fantastic the first time. But you brought it to our attention already, but that was one of the things I wanted to highlight. That it was, I was surprised that the 60 Minutes was many years ago and he's reading a book, you know, just last year. And the tone, the words, was virtually all the same. So there's something to think about there. I hope I made myself clear.
Crystal, and that CBS interview was from approximately 30 years ago. So, I mean, hey, this is a writer. Sometimes, hey, you get that script and you stick to the exact word. The next 30 years, you say it the exact same way. And apparently he has been. I'm sorry?
Sorry. I was going to say, can you plagiarize yourself?
Maybe he got it copyrighted. Maybe it sounded so nice when he said it on 60 Minutes that he went ahead and trademarked it immediately so he can just, you know, hit himself every time. And he got it in the book now, so either way, he's got it now. It's apropos of nothing, so he doesn't have to quote Emily Dickinson. He can just quote himself.
Wow. Let's see. Thank you.
Yes, sir. I guess the last one I'll get in before we get to the second audio segment. He says, was that the one? Oh, no, that's not the one I want to have. He says that this is what's out there in matrimonial court. Guys like Judge Wilk, capricious men with the power to regulate families. On several occasions, I was stopped in the street by strangers, sad men begging me to help them see their children who were taken from them in custody rulings. One wept, like I could intervene, like I'm a celebrity, so I must have some juice. I thought this was one of the more callous passages in this book. This could have been a moment. Like I said, it's like he has total wisdom of psychopaths. No connection, no empathy with anybody else. Total narcissism. This could have been a moment. Like I said, it's lots of males that I've heard talk about, man, the judge totally messed me over and I didn't get visitation and ran. All that. I've heard tons of males talk about that. I can't think of anyone who said, yeah, I got accused of sexual molestation in this process. No. But messed over on visitation and all that. Oh, yeah, that's really common. This could have been a moment where he bonds, connects with some other males, and the difficulty of being a father. This guy coming up weeping to me like I have some guy. And it's the same thing. You are a powerful white man. Maybe you do know the judge. Maybe you do know an attorney. Maybe you could do something to help out a fellow father. Like I got some juice. Like I'm powerful. Get out of here, loser. That's the exact way that it came across to me. Now, maybe that's not what he intended, but that's what it sounds like to me. And I see so few moments of connection, empathy to someone in this book who is not some sexy 17-year-old white chick or a black male entertainer. Anywho, everyone take notes. Write down thoughts so we don't forget. I'm going to try and take notes as well. Second audio segment, Simone Biles. It's the same thing. Whole system. What is white culture? Anywho, we will get to the second audio segment. We'll have ample time to share once this is done. So if you didn't get to share the first time around, be ready second time around. Woody Allen, apropos of nothing, context of white supremacy, audio segment 2.
So now back to Suni and me, hiding reclusively in my penthouse. We stayed in to avoid the paparazzi surrounding the building. We took our nature walks in my large roof garden amidst the abundant, beautiful, overgrown foliage. My penthouse was what I had fantasized as a boy. From my afternoons in the darkened cinemas where I stared at all those 35-millimeter gods and goddesses drop ice cubes into glasses of scotch and throw open the French doors to the terrace, revealing Manhattan. For years, I had been living in an apartment that could have been a film set, high above Fifth Avenue. I put in large, nearly floor-to-ceiling glass windows, and my views of the city were truly stupendous. I saw fabulous sunsets, and during electrical storms, gigantic bolts of lightning, sometimes stretching from the George Washington Bridge to the Battery. The loud thunderclap would be preceded by a majestic flash over Central Park West, over New Jersey, over eternity. Once I saw a bolt of lightning flash in the western sky and make a perfect circle, a huge letter O. Once my building was hit by lightning, the railing on my terrace to be exact. The whole building shook as lethal blocks of stone broke off the side and crashed down to Fifth Avenue. Only the intense downpour kept pedestrians from walking on the street, and so no one was hit. The block was roped off for months after while the building was repaired. Though the lightning hit 20 floors up, workers in the basement felt 9/35th rock. Many a time after, as I sat at my old metal Olympia portable and wrote during electrical storms, I was nervous a bolt would smash through the glass and strike my typewriter, barbecuing me as I pounded out a puckish satire of contemporary mores. Snowstorms and blizzards were a different experience, but equally awesome. To wake up on a winter morning and see every inch of Central Park blanketed in snow, the city silent and empty, and maybe a red fire engine would race along against the perfect white. So much depends upon a red fire engine against the snow in Central Park beside the white chickens. Close. The same great buzz occurred when April happened, and you could see the trees budding. At first, ever so slightly, and the next day, a bit more. Then a few more days, and boom! Green is everywhere, and spring has come to Manhattan, and in Central Park you see blossoms and petals unfolding, and the air smells of nostalgia, and you want to kill yourself. Why? Because it's too beautiful to handle. The pineal gland secretes unspeakable melancholy juice, and you don't know where to put all those feelings that are stampeding inside, and God forbid at that point your love life is not going too well, get the revolver. Fall is a different matter entirely, but no less emotional. To me, it's the loveliest time of the year. See, summer in New York is bad news. It's hot, muggy, everyone's away, and yes, you can move around with less traffic, but it's dull with all your friends gone and everything kind of sticky and humid. Anyhow, comes fall and the town starts percolating. New Yorkers return from vacation. The weather cools off. When I was a kid in Brooklyn, the summers were a godsend because it meant no school and I could play ball all day and hit the movies. It was fun, but even then, fall meant all the cute girls were back from camp, and although the nightmare of books and classrooms loomed, at least there would be some sigmoid anatomy to hasten the blood. I never ever went to camp, hated the idea, and tried it just once for a day. Touted to be Shangri-La, I signed up as a junior counselor, rode the train upstate, sized up the situation immediately, and called my father to come get me. Always on the lookout for trouble. He got his pal Artie, a burly enforcer with a Jake leg, and armed with guns, they drove up to spring me from this sweet little Jewish summer camp. Needless to say, there was no shootout. Finally, when you looked out the window of my penthouse and saw those leaves change color, it was both stunning and sobering. Stunning, because the reds and yellows in nature outdid all the tubes of pigment, no matter how inspiringly the painters combined them. And sobering, because the leaves soon died and fell in typical Jacobian fashion, and you knew you would one day dry and drop. The same stupid brute ritual would overtake all your own sweet little neutrinos, and what was that about? On the other hand, it's all perspective. To a human, the fall-colored leaves are gorgeous. To a red and yellow leaf, I can guarantee they find the green ones lovelier. So here I am, this guy with a Cedric Gibbons penthouse on the 20th floor in New York, but something Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer doesn't tell you or ever shows up in their movies is that penthouses leak. None of those expensive terraced apartments where the skyline is thrilling and Robert Montgomery removes a cigarette, taps it on his case, and smiles at Carol Lombard and, unlike me, doesn't forget to open the flue when there's a roaring fire in the fireplace, ever leaks. I lived in my rooftop area for 35 years, and it never didn't leak. I had in engineers. I tore up the garden and redid the roof. I caulked and put in copper pans. And yet, when it rained, out came the buckets, because when I say leaked, I don't mean a few disconcerting droplets. I mean the buckets filled up fast, and I had to repaint every year. Still, it was like being in love with a great and beautiful, exasperating woman, like Louise. The highs trumped scrambling to place the pails to catch the rainwater, and I'd probably be there still if Suni and I didn't have children and needed more space. And when Suni and I created our brouhaha, and we were the desiderata of every paparazzi, we holed up for weeks in the penthouse and took our strolls in the very large roof garden, and it was exactly the kind of you and me against the world that in a movie makes people fall more and more in love, which it did. As far as marriage was concerned, neither of us had any great need to formalize our relationship. We both felt that no contract is worth the paper it's printed on if the parties are not happy. We loved each other, and there was no need to resort to legislature. We were definitely not wed, and that was that. And then we married. Why? Not for romantic reasons, but strictly financial. I adored Sun Yi and knew I was much older and could drop dead at a moment's notice. If I did, I wanted her to be legally protected to get all I owned automatically with no hitches, as the law provides for a wife to simply take over her husband's everything upon his death. I insisted. As practical as our reason for marrying was, the wedding was very romantic. We decided on a quiet, secret wedding, just my sister, one or two friends. We decided to marry in Venice, a town we both loved. The mayor would marry us secretly in an office in his building. No one would know. All arrangements were made secretly. On a cold, dark December day in 1997, Sun Yi, my sister, and close friend Adriana De Palma, widow of my late cameraman Carlo De Palma, strolled through the streets of Venice, while I, like James Bond, counted to 500, then, dousing the lights, peeled out secretly from our suite at the Gritti Palace and took a gondola, silently gliding through the canals and backwaters to arrive at the same building from a different direction. Brought secretly into a secluded room, the mayor married us. Unobtrusively, Sun Yi and I departed separately, left the building unnoticed, and taking different routes, met back at the hotel. When we entered our suite, the phone was ringing. It was Page Six from the Post. They'd heard we were in Venice and just got married. I looked under the bed before we consummated the marriage. We honeymooned 2 days later at the Ritz in Paris, and by then the secret had become headlines. Sun Yi and I had become husband and wife. It had little effect on the stock market, although Xanax went up 10 points. As I look back on my film experience with Mia, apart from husbands and wives when everything blew up, I would have to say it was an interesting one with creative ups and downs. Things had exploded with Mia the last week of filming Husbands and Wives. Naturally, the air was full of tension. Yet we completed the shooting, gritting our teeth and both being very professional. Mia did not exactly relish the thought of working with me, having just discovered I was having an affair with Sun Yi. I didn't relish Mia phoning people telling everyone I had raped her underage retarded daughter. Husbands and Wives was the last movie Mia and I would make together. We began 13 years earlier with a Midsummer Night sex comedy. I had always wanted to do a movie that paid homage to the joys and beauty of the country. Don't ask me why. I hated the country. But the idea of magic and the music of Mendelssohn caught my fancy. And so we built from scratch the home the story takes place in. We filmed in the woods on the Rockefeller's estate up in Sleepy Hollow. I was hoping to do for the country what I tried to do for Manhattan and New York movies, show it with love. The fact I didn't love it didn't matter. After all, I was an artist, a creator, a weaver of dreams, a schlemiel in over his head. Mia was excellent, and I loved working with Jose Ferrer, whose literacy and cultivation from Shakespeare to jazz impressed me. How many actors can you hire for a role that requires singing a Schubert lead who actually knows one by heart and can sing it? We saw the perfect house for the story in a book on architecture. It existed somewhere in the Midwest. We copied the Victorian exterior exactly and rebuilt it on the Rockefeller Estate in Pocantico Hills. After the movie came out, we got sued by the owner of the original house for stealing his design. I think we won that one. Meanwhile, when the film wrapped, someone bought the house. They transported it to Long Island, did the interior according to legal building codes, and they live there to this day, hopefully happily. I made Zelig simultaneously and have described the emotional strain of switching hats all the time. No one came to see A Midsummer Night's Sex Comedy, but Zelig was much more successful. Zelig was much easier to film, as the goal was to make it look like a documentary with period footage. The sex comedy, on the other hand, took place on one single day but was shot over 3 months, and keeping the lighting consistent as the seasons changed was a real feat. We kept painting brown leaves green. Next up with Mia was Broadway Danny Rose. My range as an actor is, shall we say, limited. I can play an intellectual, which I resemble physically, but as I've said, is truly acting. I look like a bookworm, so I can be one on the screen. I'm believable as a college professor, maybe a shrink, a lawyer, an educated professional. But because of who I am naturally, I can also play a lowlife. I can be a small-time crook, a bookie, a street weasel. Danny Rose was a streety guy, an uneducated loser, a small-time hustler. In those years, I used to take Mia to Rao's, the great Italian restaurant that needs no introduction. Let me describe it this way. A couple from Texas phoned and wanted to make a dinner reservation. They were coming to New York and heard how fabulous the food was. Frankie, who ran the place before his sad, untimely death, said he could give them a table in 14 months. Mia and I often talked about her playing a character like Annie Rao. Annie and Vincent cooked and ran the joint. Annie was a fabulous character with a stacked-up blonde hair doing dangling cigarette, her New York City style of talking, her roast peppers, oh, and her ever-present sunglasses. So that was Mia and Danny Rose, and it was very different from the usual Mia Farrow, and she did a damn good job. That was a fun picture to make, and I got to work with some great acts. Alba, the bird lady, had all those talking birds and gave one to Mia, and damn, if it didn't speak beautifully. Nick Apollo Forte played the Goomba act that Danny handled as a small-time manager, and Nick did a great job. I auditioned every singer for that part, from Jimmy Roselli to Robert Goulet, and filmed a number of them. I couldn't decide between a lot of possibilities, so I called in my North Star, Keaton, and showed her the screen tests, and she said, Nick Apollo's the one. And that's all I had to hear, as my faith in her taste never faltered, and Keaton was right. He was a natural. He was a lounge act from Massachusetts who came from one of those Italian families, fishermen, as I recall. He'd tell me stories about how they fished for a living by throwing dynamite in the water, and when a multitude of dead fish floated up, they had their catch of the day. Nick never did a movie before, and I thought he'd be overcome with humble gratitude when, from all those fine singers, we'd chosen him for a leading role. But he said, you want me? You got to take my drummer. Oh, and I wrote a song I want to use. We took the drummer, who was fine. The song Nick wrote, Agita, about a nervous stomach, we used, and it was great. P.S. We got sued for it because some guy claimed Nick stole it from him. Don't know how it ended. My next movie with Mia was The Purple Rose of Cairo. I consider it one of the best films I ever made, and coming off Danny Rose gives you a good idea of Mia's range and how she got better and better, picture after picture. I originally cast Michael Keaton, a wonderful actor in the Jeff Daniels role, but there were two problems. Michael seemed so contemporary on the screen, I was having trouble buying him as a 30s character. Add to this, he had just become a father, and the baby was keeping him up all night, and he'd understandably come to work bleary-eyed. It's hard to tell an actor you're replacing him, because natural insecurity always convinces them it's because you don't like their acting. We replaced Michael with a new find of Juliet Taylor's, one whom she urged me to check out, and I resisted out of laziness, shyness, self-destruction, whatever. But the minute Jeff Daniels came in and read, our spirits rose. We knew we had hit the jackpot. Here's a truly meaningless piece of trivia. We had filmed a bit with Michael Keaton, including a long overhead night shot of the abandoned amusement park in the story. The tiny dark figure skulking around is not Jeff Daniels, but Michael Keaton. We figured no one could tell, and why stay up all night in the cold and spend a fortune to reshoot a cumbersome scene? Anyhow, I told you it was trivial. Jeff lived up to our fondest hopes and has gone on to have a fine acting career on stage and screen. I never test screen my movies. I'm not interested in collaborating with viewers to make my film. Once I hand it in, it's done. The film company can test screen and have cards filled out if it helps their marketing strategy, but don't tell me about it because I'm not interested, nor am I changing anything. So UA tested Purple Rose in Boston, and I got a nice call from one of their executives who said it went well. I thanked him for his thoughtful call. Then he said, very gingerly, you know, if you could end it more happily, it could really make some money. By that, he meant that if Mia and Jeff Daniels got together somehow, like, say, the Mermaid and Tom Hanks in Splash, I explained very politely that was not going to happen, and he very graciously dropped the subject. I had final cut, but have never had to pull rank and have always had good relations with studios and distributors. Once, when Harvey Weinstein was distributing Everyone Says I Love You, a film he bought for a lot of money, he saw, hated, and asked me to take out the word motherfucker from the rap song. I explained that I wasn't going to do that. He said if I would just cut that one word, the movie, a musical, could play Radio City Music Hall. I said, I understand, but I don't make films to accommodate movie houses. Incidentally, despite what was printed in the newspapers, Harvey never produced any movies of mine, never backed me. He only distributed a few already completed films and distributed them well. In addition to Harvey's skill at distributing, he had an eye for offbeat, artsy movies and presented a number of them. Still, I would never have allowed Harvey to back or produce a film of mine because he was a hands-on producer who changed and recut a director's movie. We never could have worked together. As far as having my movie open at the Radio City Music Hall, I had experienced that once before and didn't like it. It was not a film I directed, but only wrote, Play It Again, Sam. It did not do well there and was pulled after 2 weeks and put into a small East Side art house where it did very well. Also, I didn't think the projection at Radio City was that great. I had the same disappointment with the projection at the Ziegfeld. The throw was just too far to get a really vivid, color-saturated look. In the end, since I refused to make the cut Harvey requested, Everyone Says I Love You was not allowed into Radio City. It played elsewhere and did okay, just okay. And so Purple Rose of Cairo opened with the sad ending, and it also did okay. Originally, I had the idea that Mia would play a devoted movie buff who loses herself from her sad life by going to the movies, c'est moi, and eventually one of the characters in the film she watches, on seeing her every day in the audience, talks to her and comes down off the screen, and they have a romance. I wrote the first 50 pages and found I had nowhere to go with the story. So the 50 pages lay in my drawer for months. Then one day it occurred to me, the real live actor who plays the screen character who talks to Mia comes to town, and with two identical men, the fictional one who came off the screen and the actor live from Hollywood coming to town, many possibilities open up. The script suddenly flowed, and I made one of my favorite pictures. After that, Mia and I did Hannah and Her Sisters together. I had originally written the lead male role for an American. I had a chance to get Jack Nicholson, who wanted to do it, but was going with Angelica Houston, whose father, John Houston, was trying to get Pritzi's Honor going. And if he got it off the ground, Jack would be obliged to do it rather than Hannah. And it came to pass, Houston did get Pritzi's Honor made, and I lost my chance for Jack and turned to Michael Caine, even though I had resisted using an English actor. Still, I'd rather have a great actor like Michael and sacrifice the character being American. The end result was Jack Nicholson won an Academy Award that year for Best Actor and Michael Caine for Best Supporting. Diane Wiest also won an Oscar for her work in Hannah. Wiest is another friend and won two Oscars in my films. She's one of our greatest actresses, and even in a movie like September, which failed to charm audiences here, though I'm told played well in Zanzibar, Diane was great. Hannah was shot in Mia's actual apartment, and she was compensated by the crew doing renovating work after the movie was over. I got to direct Lloyd Nolan, a treat, second only to directing Van Johnson, because both were in so many movies I watched in the Brooklyn movie palaces growing up. Lloyd had cancer when he made Hannah, and while it necessitated him resting between calls to the set, his performing energy never let down. On Hannah, I also got a chance to work with Mia's mother, who did a good job and was also a great storyteller. Maureen O'Sullivan, as a young woman, was startlingly beautiful and hot. Tarzan was a lucky tree dweller. Maureen told me when she was in A Day at the Races, she had a little lech for Groucho, but never told him of it. Consequently, he never pitched her. Years later, I never mentioned it to him because missing out on a freebie like Maureen could have caused him a coronary. One of Maureen's many lively tales is when she was a young upcoming actress and Garbo hit on her. She evaded it, as she tells it, and passed when Garbo's assistant said, "Miss Garbo would like you to come to her dressing room." Hannah was played by Barbara Hershey, a wonderful actress. I had always wanted to work with Barbara, who was magnetic on the screen, and I had offered her the role Janet Margolin eventually played in Annie Hall. I was disappointed when she turned it down, as I was very taken with her acting depth and felt she could make a great contribution to the script Marshall Brickman and I had written. Finally, I got to work with her, and as if her acting talent was not potent enough, she was delicious to behold and gave new meaning to the word Eros. Michael Caine told me, "You get the feeling if you just go up to her and touch her, she would have an orgasm." And here I'd been shaking hands with Max von Sydow every morning. Sometimes I couldn't get my mind around the fact I was directing The Knight from The Seventh Seal. In that great film, Max's character wants to perform a meaningful act before he dies. He protects a family going through an ominous woods during a storm with death lurking. I tried to think if I had ever performed any meaningful act in my life, but besides flagging down a cab in the rain for an old lady on Sixth Avenue, I couldn't think of one. Hannah opened to a great reception, and there were some who wanted to change the Pulitzer rules so they could give it an award, but screenplays didn't qualify. The whole awards thing is so out of control. Award shows are obviously fun for people to watch, and of course they can be very lucrative for the ones who produce them, though they pay nothing to the stars who get honored. I'm thinking of the Golden Globes or the Kennedy Center, even the Oscars. At least for a Nobel, you realize they're a couple of shekels. But many awards are given only if the winner agrees to show up live to accept it. If not, they give it to someone else who will show up. Obviously, it has nothing to do with genuine achievement and everything to do with exploiting a big name who wants an ego massage. Is it any wonder in his later years, if you wanted to honor Orson Welles, he'd charge you? In radio days, Mia did a special job. She performed broad comedy, plus she sang. Her son Fletcher was in the film, looking so handsome. Radio Days was based loosely on my childhood, very loosely. Hire great performers and get out of their way. That was always my directorial secret. That and Knock Off at 5. Diane Wiest, Julie Kavner, so terrific. And that Cole Porter cameo by Keaton. I loved making that film. And Jackie Safra was so funny in the movie as the student in the speech class. He was also the very funny man on the stationary bike in Stardust Memories. And the role of the masked adventure, a radio hero played by Wally Shawn. I was first introduced by Julia Taylor to Wally Shawn for a part in Manhattan. He played Keaton's ex-husband, whom she's always describing in these overpowering and sexually aggressive terms. And Wally's persona is not like that. He's quiet and thoughtful, naturally amusing. When we shot a scene in Manhattan, the crew couldn't stop laughing. He's a great actor and a wonderful playwright. And he wrote this movie, My Dinner with Andre, a two-hander. And the director, Louis Malle, asked me to play the man opposite Andre Gregory. But I just didn't have the professional dedication to memorize the long speeches. Anyway, in the end, Wally played the role, and so much more brilliantly than I could have. Mia's range was very flexible. She could play the dopey cigarette girl in Radio Days, switch in the film to the affected gossip columnist, and then give the performance she does in the film that followed, September, a drama that asks the question, can a group of tortured souls come to terms with their sad lives when directed by a guy who should still be writing mother-in-law jokes for Broadway columnists? Here, as I said, I wanted to do something Chekhovian, One set, people in a country house, conflicting and confusing emotions. I structured it so it could be all shot indoors in a house on a set Santo built with terrific actors, all caught up in seething, anxious emotions. It would evoke an end-of-summer melancholy mood, and I would be hailed as a tragic poet and perhaps have a sandwich named after me at the Carnegie Deli. For one of the male leads, I hired Chris Walken, whom I had worked with before in Annie Hall. He played a crazy brother. Chris is one of our finest actors, and when things were not working out, I looked for the reason in the wrong place. I studied his performance to figure out the problem, but I should have been examining the writing. Always look at the writing first when something's not working. As the days passed, Chris was becoming more and more uncomfortable in the part. Finally, in the nicest, most gentlemanly way, he quit, assuring me he thought I was a brilliant director who had a great future once I beat the problem of delusional self-worship. We parted on good and friendly terms, but I always regretted letting this great actor down. I replaced Chris with Sam Shepard, whom I liked very much. Sam was never comfortable saying my words, and being a fine writer, preferred to change my speeches all the time. I never minded this, and to this day, I never mind when an actor prefers to put things in his or her own words, as long as the point of the scene is made. Anyhow, I got along well with Sam, and we talked jazz a lot, as his father played drums. Sam had a very low opinion of me as a director, and publicly said Robert Altman and I knew nothing about directing actors. I ran into him, and we talked about it, always friendly, always frank, always on good terms. When Sam's father died, he left behind boxes of jazz records, and Sam sent them all to me as a gift. He was a terrific guy, and yet another actor I let down. I wondered if drama was not my métier, and perhaps I was more at home with knockabout characters wearing bulbous rubber noses and brandishing pig bladders. September starred, among others, not only Mia, but her mother. Now, I told you what a good, lively storyteller she was in person, and I assumed her humor and energy would translate onto the screen for the flamboyant, narcissistic character she was playing, a selfish ex-actress in a household of lesser exciting mortals. Anyhow, it didn't. When I finished shooting, glued it together, and saw what I'd wrought, it was Chekhov, all right, Mo Chekhov, the plumber. No amount of imaginative editing could save it, and I decided in a moment of grandiose dementia to shoot the entire movie over. This was not as Eric von Stroheim as it sounds, since the budget was low, the set was standing in the studio, and I could probably do a new version in 6 weeks and still not exceed the original budget. I told Orion Pictures of my decision, and as long as I didn't spend more than they had originally given me, they were fine with it. As actors move on to other commitments, I was forced to recast. Mia's mother had been a major disappointment, and charming and outgoing as she was in life, she could not rev up the energy to do the self-obsessed lead character. Since I was dating her daughter, I did not look forward to bouncing her, and there were no excuses to help save face. He was just bad in the role. God bailed me out, and she took ill, not seriously, but enough so that she became unavailable, and I replaced her with Elaine Stritch. Suddenly, the role took a big uptick. Stritch was a knockout. She was brilliant, strong, funny, great to work with, and as she had married an English muffin mogul, I received cases of English muffins every Christmas for years after. Like Maureen Stapleton, Stritch was a pleasure to tease and insult, and each of them topped me and sent me limping off from their bullseye deliveries. I loved the way you take Stritch to dinner at a classy Manhattan restaurant, and she put all the rolls in a purse for midnight consumption. But as great as she was, she couldn't save me from my writing, and despite wonderful performances from everybody, September floundered. I had replaced Sam Shepard with one of my favorite actors, Sam Waterston, and Diane Wiest was her usual great self. Mia, too, gave me one of the best performances of her life in a futile cause. And so, after proving I was not Chekhov, I set out to prove I was not Ingmar Bergman. I made another woman and even used Ingmar's cameraman, Sven Nykvist. Like Sisyphus, I pushed the boulder of serious drama up the hill, and the satisfaction is in the trying. Unfortunately, the boulder keeps rolling back and crushes not only me, but also my investors who don't know from Camus and prefer to quote the late, great Jack Rollins, "Funny is money." I had the idea a long time ago that one could overhear talking through a heating vent in an apartment. My first take on that was it was a shrink's office, and I hear a lovely girl's most intimate thoughts and needs in life, and I am playing an amateur magician, and I contrive to meet her and form a relationship and make all her dreams come true since I know them. This is an idea I used in this comic romantic form years later with Julia Roberts in Everyone Says I Love You. But years before, when I was going with Mia and she was pregnant, I was trying to solve three problems: to write a story based on overhearing someone, to create a role Mia could play while pregnant and showing, and to finally establish myself as a great master of European-style drama. I came up with an idea that fit two of the three criteria, and the premise was not a bad one, if a bit pretentious and mismanaged. I wanted this woman, played superbly, of course, by the great Jenna Rollins, to be leading an unsatisfying, cold life. I wanted her to shut out everything in her life that is now unpleasant and frightening and too painful to deal with. But eventually, the truth comes through the walls, through the vent. It was a nice idea, and in more skillful hands, could have worked better. I gave it my best shot, got to work with Jenna and, in a small role, Gene Hackman. I also got to work with Sven, who was among the numerous illustrious men Mia had had a romance with previously. I recall when I first dated Mia, I was so overmatched. She was beautiful and had grown up among Hollywood royalty. She knew everyone in movies, from Betty Davis to Katharine Hepburn to Charles Boyer, and I'd take her for dinner up at Rao's, and first we'd see a Bergman film, and she'd tell me about her romance with his brilliant cameraman, Sven Nykvist. On the car radio en route to dinner, the Mozart Symphony was being conducted by her ex-husband, Andrei Previn, a musical wunderkind. And she knew all the great classical artists, Daniel Barenboim, Vladimir Ashkenazi, Itzhak Perlman, Pinchas Zukerman. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there hoping to impress this beautiful blonde somehow. Then at Rao's, the jukebox is playing Sinatra. For me, a god. For her, yet another lover, an ex-husband. A million stories and anecdotes about Frank, his family, Palm Springs, Vegas. Who did I know? Mickey Rose, who I wrote Take the Money and Bananas with, who played third base when I played second, and who left cans of tuna fish around town. I knew Marshall Brickman, a funny guy who walked the streets with me, confounded as I was over how a woman with a pretty figure instinctively knows to turn her head away when you're driving by in a car trying to see her face. And David Panish, who had a different loaded gun within easy reach in every room of his apartment because he suspected an imminent Nazi uprising. She knew Comden Green and Steve Sondheim. I knew Keaton, her sisters, her Grammy Hall, and George the Border, who refused to roll the dice in Vegas because he believed each person has just so much luck in life and he didn't want to use up any portion of his on a crap table. But I babbled. The movie proceeded, and to me, the only significant part of that was shortly after Mia had Satchel, whom she carried on the set during the next film.
Context of white supremacy. Babbling should be avoided in the system of white supremacy. So that is audio segment two. We should have two, three more sections left to go before we are all done with Apropos of Nothing, Woody Allen. The number to dial is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Email is untiljustice@gmail.com. Don't wait till the last minute if you have commentary. Make sure I get in our investor his additional comments now that we got in the rest of the reading. Number four, Maureen O'Sullivan, Mia Farrow's mother, played Jing to Olympic swimmer Johnny Weissmuller's Tarzan in movies in the 1930s. During the 1960s, they were shown relentlessly on afternoon kids television shows. Tarzan, that is like, I said, man, even if you don't know all of these people, because I don't, you know, Maureen O'Sullivan, like, I would lose that. If somebody asked me, you know, who is that? Can you name a television program? I would have lost that. I didn't need to. Let me get my phone. Let me search it really quick. But this is like the foundation of Netflix. This is the foundation of white supremacy entertainment for like the last 100 years. All these folks that Woody Allen is talking about that he knows and worked with and enjoyed and all that and was hobnobbing with for the last 50 years, more than that, really, 60, 70 years, and presidents and what have you. This is the foundation of white supremacy entertainment. Tarzan. White man take over the jungle. Metaphor for racism. That's in the ISIS paper. Dr. Welsing talks about that. Number 5, Polaroids discovered in my apartment would change the course of Western civilization. Using sarcasm to minimize this egregious act. Again, I think that's also a form. I think that's totally accurate because he does a lot of that. But I think that's also, I think it's both. Like sometimes it can be kind of double entendre, multiple meanings. The sarcasm, absolutely. But I also think like within that, like he believes that, like he said before, like this has created this $1 million industry and harmed all these people. Like he totally like, yes, I am that important. Woody Allen, the center of Western civilization. Like, yeah, that's what he thinks. That's his entire book has been a tour de force of what is Western what is Western white civilization. And my movies and I represent that for New York City in this era as best as anyone, better than anyone else right now as a white person. Let's see. If folks have thoughts, observations to share, why do you think Woody Allen wrote this here book? Anything else that stood out as important, feel free. The folks who are with us, I'll share thought or two. And then, yeah, we'll double check and see if folks have things that have stood out as important in what we've read thus far. Let's see. He says... cute girl. We got another mention of girls right at the beginning of the second audio segment. Every time you mention Central Park, I think it's Central Park 5. And when he talks about he and Soon-Yi getting married, even though they had said that, we're not into paper and all that, blah, blah, blah. And so then we get married. And he says, not for romantic reasons, but strictly financial. I adored Soon-Yi and knew I was much older and could drop dead at a moment's notice. Now that right there, like... what? What? And they got together allegedly when she's 20. How was that? If I did, I wanted her to be legally protected to get all I owned automatically with no hitches, as the law provides for a wife to simply take over her husband's everything upon his death. I insisted. Now, Woody Allen's been hanging out, you know, good 30 years since then, so obviously he didn't keel over and die. The mayor would marry us secretly in an office in his building. No one would know. All arrangements were made secretly. The word secret mentioned twice there is people do conspire about some things. And who knows the mayor in like Venice where you can travel? That's what I mean. Like he keeps saying, oh, I'm a schlemiel. I'm dumb. I'm stupid. I'm ignorant, as whites often say. Who is a hey? Can you call the mayor in Venice and get us an extra super special secret wedding ceremony? Cool. In his private office? Cool. Okay. We'll be there on Friday. Like, what? Okay, Woody. He says, he didn't relish Mia Farrow phoning people, telling everyone I had raped her underage, retarded daughter. This is something that Moses Farrow, I believe, and Woody bring up, Woody Allen bring up regularly, that Mia Farrow told people that Soon-Yi was retarded and that she was raped. I guess it would depend on when this so-called romance started. He's saying it started when she's 20, if that's accurate, I guess legally. The retarded aspect, hey, non-white people in the system of white supremacy are all retarded, just going by the definition. That said, I don't know if she meant the medical definition of the word retarded. I don't know if that's what she meant or what have you. I am not a doctor. I do not know. But that is a common allegation that Woody Allen and others will make, his defenders will make, that Mia Farrow referred to Sun Yi as retarded. Him having access to the Rockefeller estate to do movies as well, I thought, white power, not privilege. Let's see. Get one more and then I can check in some of the folks, see if they have any comments from the second. Okay, see, this is the same thing where he says, next up with Mia was Broadway Danny Rose. My range as an actor is, shall we say, limited. I can play an intellectual, which I resemble physically, but as I've said, it's truly acting. I look like a bookworm, so I can be one on the screen. I'm believable as a college professor, maybe a shrink, a lawyer, an educated professional, because of who I am naturally. I can also play a lowlife. I can be a small-time crook, a bookie, a street weasel. Ooh, fascinating. Your true self, right? Street weasel. Okay. Believe people when they tell you who they are. I found it interesting and revealing about what it means to be white that Woody Allen can play an intellectual. Why? It's only because he's white. There's nothing else about him. If this was a black guy who looked like Woody Allen, small in stature, wears glasses and all that, like, would he be an intellectual? It'd just be a Negro with glasses. Like, why would he be an intellectual? Why can Woody Allen, just because of the way that he looks, why is it, oh yeah, I could look like a shrink? I don't even, what does a shrink look like? A psychologist, meaning? Or a lawyer? I don't know. Like, when those police officers pulled over Johnny Cochran, I don't think they looked at him and thought, this guy looks like he could be a lawyer. A shrink, maybe. He's a Negro with glasses. But in addition to all of that, that is important. He, like, throws in one little sentence. He does this consistently. Next up with Mia, and talking about the different movies that he and Mia worked on, he doesn't include, like, any, like, real detail. Like, he'll give a little snippet here and there about what Mia did, but most of this is just about other people and his adjustment. Wait a minute. Yeah, most of this is not, you know, talking in any depth about Mia per se. He's talking about things that happen with other white people and his little experiences and that sort of thing. Most of this is focused on his autobiography. I'm just pointing that out. Most of this is about Woody Allen, not, you know, any detail about anybody else, really. Even though he might try and trick us with it. Next up with Mia. It's not balanced at all what Mia was up to. And even why this is included this way. If they've already had their break, why couldn't this be included, you know, previously? So we broke. Now we can be moving forward. Sun Yi, all that. I'll stop there. Let's see. Folks who dialed in, if y'all have any commentary, thoughts from the second audio segment.
Gus. Chief,
yes, sir.
Renegade. I made some notes this time, Mr. Renegade. And you always say the type of thing that I would like to pick up. Going back to the first section, he made a comment about maybe there's a woman in the dungeon. He said about something. I was thinking to myself, that might be a sign to someone. I know I've got some stuff on you, so, you know, be careful. Anyway, that's a bit far-fetched. Right, on the second section, I started with more boasting. As he starts, he said he has a large garden, a roof garden, and then he said he got large windows, you know. He could have said, I went to the roof garden and left it at that, but no, it had to be a large roof garden. And then it made me laugh when a couple paragraphs later, he said he went to, or he was in, the very large roof garden, you know. So it went from a large roof garden to a very large roof garden. The man is so conceited, it's unreal. Anyway, that's my first note. The second note was a secret marriage. And you mentioned the word secret. But the way he said it, it was seedy to me. That's not the way a marriage should be. A marriage should be a celebration of joy and togetherness with the people you love. Obviously, it's just his sister and a friend who he can say he loves. And I did make a little comment, vile, you know, to have a marriage like that. I know he's a famous person and they do stuff in secret, like Britney Spears, but it didn't sound like a nice marriage at all. And then he said, and you said it was for financial arrangements. And then he said, magic. And whenever I think of magic, I think of deception, which is what magic is. And then, without even drawing a breath, he brought sex back into it. And then we jumped and consummated the marriage. I didn't think it was necessary to actually say that. It's just his seedy side. Bursting to get out. Anyway, that's one. Another thing was, after that, he said Mira found that he was having an affair with her daughter. Now, I just found it strange that he was saying affair and not he started dating her daughter or something like that, but they have an affair. I don't know what you want to think about that. And then he said magic again, and Mendelssohn, orchestra, a classical composer. And those two things, once again, I just didn't like it. Magic and Mendelssohn. And then, as you said later on, believe the person when they say what they are. Well, he did it twice in that case, because I missed the one that you brought up. The one that I wrote then, he says, I'm a creator of dreams. Yeah. And to me, if you're a creator of dreams, you're a liar. And that's what he said about himself. I'm a creator of dreams. So he's doing the same thing there in the book, as I tried to tell you initially. It feels like my mind's being programmed like I'm in a dream. Anyway, that's another point, another quick one. He didn't say, he didn't say a bad word about Harvey Weinstein, you know. He didn't really run him down like he does other people with nasty things. Another comment was said nice stuff about the actor. Yeah, the actor that he cast in the film said a nice thing about it. He was a nice actor. He wouldn't take me unless I had a music and unless he took the drummer. And he was really, really good and the music sold and everything was great. And then he said, but then someone got in touch. And he said, he stole my record. You know, once again, Mr. Renegade, I just didn't think it was necessary to be included. He could have said he was a good drummer and the record sold and that was it. But no, he had to give him a little uppercut, I like to say. He stole the record anyway. It wasn't his, you know, just to sully his name. That's all the notes I've made. I'm enjoying the show. I hope I made myself clear.
Absolutely. Can we get a time stamp, sir, before you mute yourself? Or?
Well, I don't know. It's about 3:30 or something like that.
You said half, what was it?
3:30. I'm not too sure. I'm not by a clock, but it's very late. Must be about 3:30, 4:00.
Wow. Friday morning. Much obliged, Coherent. Thank you for sharing. And the importance, him saying it's secret, the wedding. He said it multiple times. Secret wedding.
Yeah.
In Venice. Uh-huh. Where a wedding normally it's not a secret. Normally that's how many people can we invite, even especially if it's a powerful white person. Like, ooh, you really get to show out. Like, you invite your cool friends and family, and we get to have the biggest, talk about large, like, ooh, we're going to have the largest cake and the largest decorations and the largest feast possible to show out and commemorate this moment with all of our close family and friends. And then we'll make a big to-do, come over and vent. Secret. Secret, secret.
Yeah.
Seedy.
Seedy.
Exactly. Excellent. Excellent word usage. Like, exactly. Like, this is not like a proud occasion, you know, to celebrate and be. That's what a marriage is supposed to be, is celebrate. Let's sneak out of the country.
Mr. Renegade.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to add something from last week, but I fell asleep. I was thinking, when you got a criminal, murderer, car thief, burglar, whatever, they say they like to return to the scene of the crime. That's what is told. And they like to get things off their chest and actually tell somebody what they've done, you know. So I was thinking, who can Woody Allen tell about his philandering? You know, I think this is another avenue for him to gloat and to talk about his sex life, you know. And in between the lines, he's boasting like he does about everything, about his sexual behavior, and he's once again trying to deceive us magically with words. But I think perpetrators of this kind, they like to talk about what they've done. That's just something that I had on my mind for a little while. What do you think about that, Mr. Renegade? I hope I make myself clear.
It was lucid to me. Folks listening in, if you have a question or something didn't seem precise or well explained to you, doesn't seem logical, that's how Mr. Allen says. Is that common sense? Is that logical? What unknown from the unknown galaxy just said? *61, and I'm sure he can explain. But to me, that is exactly, and I mean verbatim, why we are reading this book. It goes back to when you said before, you said the snippet that you heard, the reading from this audiobook, are you sure that wasn't just a teaser to try to rope you into reading this book where he's just going to babble and talk about nonsense? And I was like, no, I think we just maybe got to be patient, because it seemed pretty exactly what you just said. That was the word I used. He was so cavalier in the way that he was talking about having sex with Soon Yi. It was just like, what in the, this is like brag, the word you just used, bragging, which is right up there with being cavalier in how you present, but bragging about his sexual conquest. And I mean, that's right up there with Tarzan, like putting notches on the belt for sexual conquest. Like, that's what this sounded like. This didn't sound like someone who was ashamed. This didn't sound like someone who had regrets. This sounded like, yeah, I'm with this young 20-year-old. Man, I am Woody Allen. Look at me.
Even made a film about it.
Totally. Totally. I mean, that's why we're reading this book. I was absolutely, because I am not accustomed to people being that bragging in that sort of manner about what some regard as perhaps criminal behavior, if that makes sense. But Mr. Fuller, he says Mr. Fuller, and this is a tragic arrangement, keep that in mind, this is everybody's favorite subject matter, he says racism, white supremacy is about racist man and racist woman bragging about mistreating non-white people, practicing racism. Mr. Fuller has said that repeatedly, having fun bragging about mistreating us. But did you have something you were going to add in there, or?
I was just agreeing with you, Mr. Renegade.
Double check. Did any of the other folks who dialed in, comments that you all wanted to make sure you get in, I'll check again once I share a few other thoughts. But oh, and the large, I said that as well. White genetic annihilation. Dr. Francis Kress Welsing talked about that. I feel so much of that is in this book as well, in terms of the narcissism, all of it, all of it. Him being with this non-white female, all of it. But large, very large emphasis, so many different ways of compensating for genetic or melanin deficiency, white genetic annihilation. That's such a hallmark. She talks about a white culture finding different ways to compensate. Getting a or getting someone non-white female who is 35 years younger than you, that might qualify flagrantly. So let's see.
Mr. Renegade, can I just say one quick last thing?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to get your opinion. When he says, he just repeated it a while ago, a large garden. I went to the large roof garden, I think he said. And then a paragraph later, he said, I went to the very large roof garden. Don't you think that's a very twisted mind trying to program you? Because I think, first of all, he puts the thought into your head, okay, it's a large garden. And then it's like you forget about that. And he's, oh, it's a very large part. You know, it's that kind of programming that I kind of get from the way he frames his sentences and puts his side of the story. Do you have a view about that? I know it's kind of minor, but what do you think?
Excuse me. Let me swallow. More water. Stay hydrated, folks. I think I've been asking repeatedly, like, why do we think Mr. Allen wrote this book and that was published in the middle of 2020, year of the Rona, to be persuasive? And you, I think you said it the first time, you said it a few times now, but you said it way back when, after we finished the first audio segment, that you felt like, man, it feels like the way that he wrote this book feels like it's programming my brain. Like, that is a powerful statement. Like, this is a celebrated white writer who is skilled with word use and being persuasive in lots of different ways. So if that's persuading you that I didn't rape anybody, I didn't molest anybody, that is a no count, scorned, scheming white woman, I'm just an ignorant old schlemiel. If it's persuading you in that way, if it's persuading you in just, wow, the brilliance of my films and my life and my penthouse with this amazing view of Manhattan and Central Park and the large garden and then the very large, like, sometimes just the opulence of his experiences, sometimes that's, it's just to wow you, like, wow, he is so clever and so funny and wow, what a life he has led. Like, they're supposed to be doing a documentary, like, based on his life and this book to some degree, I guess. So he is a skilled, powerful white man who I'd say is very knowledgeable with being persuasive. So I think that's probably what it is, whether it's the, you know, the opulence and the large garden or I didn't molest anybody. Let's see. If other folks have any thoughts on that, you can share our last few minutes. Let's see. Any other? I thought the Tarzan reference was important as well, where he talked about Mia Farrow's mother coming in and working on some of the films. That's why I said just the foundation of white supremacy, racism in what we're reading. Also, in terms of persuasion, the question that was just asked. In my opinion, other folks, if you're listening to the archives or what have you, you can compare to like next week because we got more to go. His tone for the first audio segment was so different. I mean, I'm not going to say exactly he was yelling, but it sounded substantially different from the kind of laissez-faire, almost comical tone that he has at times in reading this book. I would even have to look at the meter to see if his volume went up at that point, but it sounded, the energy sounded substantially different. When he spoke, talking about the court case and the Judge Wilkes and all of that, that Dylan has just been a victim of brainwashing and all the rest of this. Yeah, I'd be interested to hear folks' thoughts there as well. In terms of other quick points that I thought were worthwhile from what we read. Let's see. To work with Mia's mother. Okay, we just got that in. Tarzan. Let's see. Oh, did I get screen? There we go. It's having problems scrolling. Okay. He says, finally, I got to work with her. Make sure I get the actress' name. Janet Margolin, who died at the age of 50. He says, finally, I got to work with her. And as if her acting talent was not potent enough, she was delicious to behold and gave new meaning to the word eros. Michael Caine told me, you get the feeling if you just go up to her and touch her, she would have an orgasm. Again, the bragging about the sexual exploits and what have you. And again, all of the, when the females are mentioned in the text, it's always hyper sexualized. When he's talking about the actress who played in Tarzan, Mia Farrow's mother, she's hot. You know, it's always hyper sexualized. Okay, knocked my audio out briefly. Let's see. Next. When he talks about all this with the Oscars and how this is kind of a big racket and what they're doing, if you're not willing to come and show up, then they'll give it to somebody else who will and all that, like, lots of nonsense, lots of bogus awards. And if anything, that would be, forget all the awards. Let's just focus on producing justice. We can pile up all the phony, bogus awards later on. Let's see. Delusional self-worship was what he was told by the actor who quit the film. Let's see. Make sure I get the name in correctly. Oh. Yep, it would vote.
Christopher Walken.
Thank you. Thank you. I couldn't find where the name is. But yeah, the delusional self-worth. I think there are a few times where, hey, that's flagrant throughout the text. Let's see, much obliged, unknown from unknown galaxy. He has so much. He was quoting Oedipus Rex at the beginning of the book, and it's in his films too. Mighty Aphrodite, so it's throughout the arc of his body of work. And he comes back to referencing himself as Sisyphus. This is also a character in Greek mythology. You push the rock up the hill, it gets pushed back down. And again, it's the same thing I've been saying, like, woe is me, victim Woody Allen, poor old white dude. Like, what are you talking about? Like, you're sneaking off to Venice to get married to some 20-year-old and all the, like, come on. Let's see. Oh, and then wait a minute, I missed one. He said, God bailed me out and she took ill. So I got to save face. She was just bad in the role. She became unavailable and I replaced her with Elaine Stritch. Suddenly the role took a big uptick. Stritch was a knockout. First thing before, she was brilliant, strong, funny, great to work with. She was a knockout. And then he got all these muffins. And he also says she was a pleasure to tease and insult. I think that's a big part of white culture as well. Racism, white supremacy, not just to insult. I mean, to companionship, to work and enjoy, and work to tease and insult. That level, what we said at the beginning with Marv Albert, sadomasochism. Can't just be to enjoy somebody's company. It's got to be some level of punishment and derision with all of this. Sarcasm is an element of that. A lot of that in Woody Allen's films, I would say. Let me see. Anything else? Make sure I got in. Oh, and the projection. Same thing where he gives this big, I guess he's got to get another dig in at Mia Farrow. He says, I also got to work with Sven, who is among the numerous illustrious men Mia had had a romance with previously. Now, Woody Allen had been married 2-3 times already, but whatever. I recall when I first dated Mia, I was so overmatched. Really? She was beautiful and had grown up among Hollywood royalty. She knew everyone in movies, from Bette Davis to Katharine Hepburn to Charles Boyer, and I'd take her for dinner up to Rao's, and first we'd see a Bergman film, and she'd tell me about her romance with his brilliant cameraman, Sven Nykvist. On the car radio en route to dinner, the Mozart Symphony was being conducted by her ex-husband, Andre Previn, who adopted Sun Yi, a musical wunderkind, and she knew all the great classical artists, Daniel Barebone, Vladimir Ashinsky, mispronounced it, my apologies, Itza Perlman, Pincus Zuckerman. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there hoping to impress this beautiful blonde somehow. Blonde, not just a beautiful female, but a beautiful blonde. Then at Rao's, the jukebox is playing Sinatra for Me, a God. That's another one in the system of racism, white supremacy. He, and this is for musicians. Remember way back when he was talking about all the worship that he had for Louis Armstrong? He described Louis Armstrong and New Orleans jazz artists, black artists, as primitive. Frank Sinatra is a god. They're both playing music. One is primitive, and it was twice. It was the same way, like Large Garden, Very Large Garden, within the same paragraph, really quick, primitive. And then I got to say it again for emphasis in case you forgot, these Negroes in New Orleans are primitive. Frank Sinatra is a white god. And I just want to state for the record again, it's no caping for Mia Farrow, because these folks are all doing the same thing. Mia Farrow was 20, I believe. I might be off by like a year, 2021. They crucify you for that if you're off by a couple of months about this. One of the two. She was like 2021. Frank Sinatra was 50 when they got married. So, I mean, they're all into this white culture, all into the same thing. The wife swapping and swinging, they call it, and having sex with children and NAMBLA and all of that. That is about going to the Playboy Mansion. Like, it's right in your face. It's right in your face the whole time. So I'm not caping for Mia Farrow. I'm not saying that she was a great mom or any of that. She's adopting non-white children. That is an act of racism, white supremacy. And I mean, hey, the sexual, some of the accusers, like I said they participated in three ways with Woody Allen and Mia Farrow. So, hey, all of that could be true. It could be that she was dating the judge or whatever he was trying to hook up with her. White culture. What does it mean to be white? That's why we're reading this here book. I will pause there as we have more to go. You didn't miss anybody? Anybody? No thoughts? Grand. We'll assume folks are satisfied for the week. We have more audio to go before we are done. We'll be here tomorrow, same broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, neutralizing workplace racism. And then Saturday, compensatory call-in. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest. If you think the program is constructive, visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button in the top right corner. You'll see the links, Venmo, Cash App, PayPal. Much obliged for the folks who have supported for 12 years. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We are going to need high level thinking to diffuse all of the deception, white supremacy, racism, word masters like Woody. That some of it is right in your face. You change your name to Woody. Anyway, in addition to being sober, man, especially if you're in the U.S., really, you know, anywhere, because they've been protesting and it's been so wild, but especially here in the U.S., there's so many armed whites. Be very cautious. If you're out and about, somebody's being hostile and loud, exit. If you did not leave your residence prepared to kill and or die, evacuate. That's what they say. You have no idea. You should be thinking this person could be armed. In fact, he could have an entire entourage armed, ready to kill. if you're going to go out, if you're driving, you are sober. If you are behind the wheel, you're not on the cell phone. We need all of our attention, and we're trying to avoid contact with the Mark Furmans of the known universe. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. No name calling, no gossiping. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.